officer for MnDOT. I do have a cold. If I'm speaking too loudly or something, please let me know.
Thank you. Now I can hear you.
In 2005, over 4,000 Minnesota citizens expressed opinions to our market research department that helped us make some hard decisions about decreasing or increasing resources and establishing priorities for programs. As you know, if you poll in your districts, the value of market research is in the details. Probably one of the first questions if a person comes to you with a complaint, at least in the back of your mind, will be, does this person reside in my district? That's as it should be. We might need to know the addresses, the size of your family, how many vehicles you own, what size of vehicles you own, when you're using the highways, which highways you're using, and what are your travel patterns in order to get the information that we need to use. But what we've learned in doing this is that when we inform the participants that their names, home and business addresses, and telephone numbers are public data, and their associated opinions are public data, and will be available to anybody for any reason, they very often decline to participate. It's increasingly difficult to obtain participation. Now, just this evening, a private citizen remarked to our director of market research, who is here in case you have any technical questions, that she's delighted that MnDOT comes to her and asks her opinion, and she would like to support light rail on University Avenue. But if her name and address are public, she won't do it because she's afraid her neighbors will be upset with her. And that's the kind of thing this legislation would protect. We're asking you to think about whether all the data in the Safe Routes to School program should be public, where we're trying to help families pick out the safest route for their children to walk to school. Remember that I can't require people to tell me why they want the data. I can only supply the data. And we want you to think about how the data classification makes that data available to absolutely anyone. Three professional national organizations in market research all have ethical codes of behavior that require keeping this data private. And we believe that that's the way we need to go. In fact, MnDOT's in the awkward position of having professional employees who are trying to follow their professional ethics, who may have to reveal information that their ethics would tell them they should not reveal. So we ask for this legislation because we think it protects MnDOT from having to give out data that could be used inappropriately. Our second section concerns the overhead rate. We're one of only two states in the nation who have approval to use this method of keeping the cost of consultants low. Any consultant who wants to do work with MnDOT has to submit an annual financial plan and a stockholder list. We have professional auditors who analyze all this information, and they create two forms called a Schedule of Audit Adjustments, which reviews all the financial data and subtracts the data that's not allowed to be considered under the federal acquisition regulations, the FAR rules. Things like lobbying efforts, company bonuses, company parties, that sort of thing is not allowed to figure into the cost of overhead that we pay for our projects. We apply a formula to the totals, and that's worked out on our document called the overhead rate schedule. And we apply the formula to get a percentage that tells us how much overhead each consultant is entitled to be paid. We cap that at 155%. Of the last 70 audits that we performed, 37 of the companies came in with overhead rates in excess of 150%, and yet we will cap our payments at 155%. So it's been a very effective measure to keep the cost of consulting low. The same data submitted to the Minnesota Department of Revenue are protected and are not available to the public. Also, the same data submitted to the federal government under their cost monitoring procedures are also protected and not available to the public. So again, we're in the position where MnDOT employees may be required to release information that other agencies would not be able to release. Now, the consultant firms believe that if their competitors get a hold of this information, it would be very damaging to their marketing, investment, and financial strategies. And our auditors tend to concur with that belief. In fact, two companies have recently decided not to participate in MnDOT work because they don't want to submit the information, knowing what their level of exposure could be. If that trend were to continue, we would have a diminishing pool of consultants. Having to share this information is almost like having your tax advisor or your financial advisor share your information with your neighbors. And that's why we're asking to protect just those four documents, the financial statement, stockholders list, the audit adjustment schedule, and the overhead rate schedule. The third little section concerns our bid escrow documentation. This is one of the greatest dispute resolution processes I've seen in a long time. We've used it for about 12 years. On a small percentage of our construction projects, but only on our construction projects, a contractor, once they're awarded a contract, has to provide all of the data that they use to get their bid that we opened up on bid opening day. They give it to us in a sealed envelope. Together with them, it is deposited in a bank safety deposit vault and not opened at that time. The only time it's opened is if there's a dispute during the life of the project where the information would be helpful. So it provides a very accurate historical basis for determining the cost of certain items. It's good for the contractors, and it's good for MnDOT. Now, the bid escrow documentation can contain sensitive information. Negotiations with vendors and suppliers will be in there. Notes about phone calls back and forth. Well, if you give me 100 yards of gravel at this, can you give me 10 yards of larger gravel at this price? All of that data would be in there. Sensitive salary and benefit costs. Sometimes if you have a $500,000 piece of equipment, you will pay a premium for an operator to operate that. Or if you have a complex project, you may need a specific foreman or supervisor. And so you will pay a premium for those people. And that would all be information in here. Would not contain prevailing wage information about employees on the project, which is always public information. Might contain actual costs of operating a specific piece of equipment, which could include loan amortization and things like that, which would indicate the financial position of the company. Contractors believe that access to this data will negatively affect their future bidding because other companies will be able to identify specific costs for equipment and salary costs. We believe it's a good idea to protect the data because the only reason it works is that contractors give us truthful, honest, and thorough information up front. And they're confident that it's protected because it's in the safety deposit box. However, if someone requested it, it still is data that we have received. It is owned by MnDOT, and it is subject to the Data Practices Act. So we would ask that that information be protected and classified as private or non-public data as well. We believe it has saved us thousands and thousands of dollars and prevented lots of litigation by allowing us to get good historical, accurate data that lets us settle issues with contractors very easily compared to going to court. So those are the three areas that we're asking for your consideration.
Thank you. Ms. Forslund, members, do you have questions for this witness, Senator Betzold?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. Forslund, just a couple of questions. Back on Section 1, we're classifying as private data the everything but zip codes. The zip codes would still be public data as I read this. Is that correct?
That's right.
And what then is available to the public then? I mean, are the survey results identifiable by zip code is? What information, if somebody comes and says, I would like to see something, do you just give them a list of zip codes? What happens?
Senator, thank you for the question. What would be available would be all the other data gathered, which might be four households in zip code 55416 that contained four members with two automobiles drive 150 miles per day to go to work, six households in zip code 55416 with three members drive 200 miles daily to get back and forth to work. So they would get all the data, just not be able to associate it with an individual name, address, or telephone number.
Okay, and Madam Chair.
Senator Petzold.
Section 2, I think we've tried to make the financial statements of organizations not necessarily the public information, because that might give competitive advantages, you know, to others. But could you discuss again the list of shareholders? Why would the list of shareholders be something that, you know, would not be public?
Ms. Forsland?
Chairman, thank you. Stockholders' lists of public companies are available in other venues. And so stockholder lists for that type of company would be available to someone needing the information. They wouldn't necessarily get it from us. So that leaves the smaller companies. We have one company, for instance, that is wholly owned by employees. Now, employees may buy stock on a payroll deduction plan. And so a list of stockholders in that case lists all the employees by name and shows the percentage of stock they've got. It might show the percentage they buy each payday or each month or each year as well. And we felt that that was intrusive, and that knowing that information, particularly about these smaller companies that are not public, is not necessary to the general public. It doesn't improve the value that the state gets in the construction or in the performance of the professional technical contracts to know who owns that stock, particularly in smaller families. Some family companies that you think are family will have family distributions of stock, and we felt that it was appropriate to protect that data.
But, Madam Chair.
Senator Betzold.
When I see lists of stockholders, or shareholders, I think would be a more appropriate term, I just think of just a list of names, not necessarily what they're buying or selling it for, or their investment. Why wouldn't it be something of public information as to know who the names, the shareholders are, who are involved in these rate transactions? Why wouldn't we want to know who they are?
Senator Betzold, what we need the information for and what we track is to see if there have been stock transactions over the past year that indicate that the financial stability of the company is not what it should be. When our auditors get these materials, they really have two purposes. One is they must evaluate the financial stability and ability to perform of the company. And the second one is to establish the overhead rate. And they believe that access to the stockholder information, which includes percentage of ownership or number of shares and that sort of thing, gives them useful information. We do have in attendance Mr. Dan Conkey, who's the director of our audit department. This may be the kind of question that he could answer more efficiently than I, if you would like to hear from him.
Well,
Senator Betzold.
Madam Chair, I guess I am interested. Again, you know, you're referring to the financial data, you know, the list. I just read this as the list of stockholders, which I read that as just a list of names. And you keep adding more to that. I'm just saying, why would the list of names be something that, you know, would not be public? I don't get that.
Senator Betzold, I think
Ms.
that's...
Ms. Forsland?
Thank you, okay. Chair. I think the error is perhaps in our choice of words there. We do have some samples of stockholder lists that we could provide to you, and they do show the names of the stockholder, which we have blacked out from our samples, and the percentage of stock they own or the number of shares they own. And that's the total package of information that is needed. So perhaps lists of stockholders was not the wisest choice of words there. It is intended to show the amount of ownership each stockholder has.
Well, Madam Chair, I'll ask a few more questions because I'd like to get back to that. In Section 3, it talks about, you talked about the escrow data. In the first sentence, says a bid documentation held in escrow is classified as non-public. The next sentence says any data on individuals in the bid documentation are classified as private data on individuals. And most of the rest I'm reading in that paragraph doesn't seem to be referring to individual data. It talks about, various stuff, and I'm not quite sure. Are you referring to any personal data that is in this escrow data?
Ms. Forsland?
Madam Chair and Senator Betzel, yes, when we reviewed this, we learned that specific employee salaries could be included in there by name. For instance, the highly skilled specialty operator, sometimes there's a project management team, and those salaries are computed in there. So those employees' names, salaries, and cost of their benefit packages would be in the document. However, those employees are not necessarily covered by the prevailing wage statute. So that would be private information on those individuals. And that's why we felt we needed to include that sentence.
Madam Chair,
Senator Betzel,
is there other information? Again, this says any data on individuals. You've identified salary data and benefit packages. Is there anything else?
Ms. Forsland?
Madam Chair and Senator, I'm not aware of anything else that's currently required, although it could be that loan information might include the names of co-signers to loans or something like that that would come up in the future.
Senator Betzel?
I may have some amendments here, but I'll defer to public testimony or others right now, Madam Chair.
Senator Limmer?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Rest, we use the terms private data and non-public data. And we use them kind of, we interchange these words, and I'm just wondering, is there a difference between non-public and private?
Perhaps council would like to address that question. Senator Rest, is that acceptable?
Yeah, I fooled another one.
Madam Chair, Senator Limmer, it's just the same type of classification. Data on individuals is about a human being. And non-public is something other than a human being, like a business entity or something like that. But both types of data are not accessible to the public, but they are accessible to the subject.
All right. And one other question. I came in a little late. Could someone tell me if the term overhead rate is a defined term in the statute? I don't know what overhead rate means.
Ms. Forsland, do you know?
Madam Chair and Senator, I think we will defer that question to our director of our audit operations. I do know that it's a term of art used in our business, but I do not know whether it's specifically defined in the statutory language anywhere. I suspect not. Would you be interested to hear from Mr. Conkey, Madam Chair?
I think we will want to hear from Mr. Conkey, Ms. Forsland. But before we call Mr. Conkey, I have a few questions myself or comments I'd like to make, but I just want to make sure that the other members don't have any additional questions first. And just to preface my questions, since this is the first meeting we've had in data practices, and I'm new to data practices and to chairing a committee, but with respect to this issue, we have had some conversation before the this meeting tonight, and my concern is that when we have data that is not required to be private data, that's data that's originated through government agencies and taxpayer dollars are used to generate that data, that normally my preference is that that data remains public data without a very compelling reason to make it private, because we have, I guess, there are a couple of reasons for that. Transparency in how the government operates is very important to me. Even though I'm a member now of the government myself, I don't expect the public to take what we're doing take us at our word for things when we should give them an opportunity to examine what we're doing. And so when you talk about the need for your department to evaluate things, I think there's also a need for the public to evaluate what we're doing to the extent that it's possible to allow that. The first part of your change on subdivision 4 that has to do with market research data, you certainly mentioned some areas where I believe there would be a concern for and a reasonable concern why someone might want to make data private. But I think that you use this data. Am I correct in assuming that these surveys are sometimes used to determine how to spend public dollars, whether to go ahead with a project or not go ahead with a project, or to evaluate how public money is going to be spent?
Madam Chair, that's exactly what the data are used for, but they're only one of several avenues of inquiry that the agency would use to reach a decision. It is a good way to take the temperature of the public. You'll probably recall the ramp meter problem, where as an agency we had timed the ramp meters to keep the freeways clear for emergency vehicles, and then we were required to do more public surveys to see what the temperature of the public opinion was. And unfortunately, I lost. I liked that system, but the vast majority of the public wanted the ramp meters staggered so that they could get on the freeways more quickly, even if they had to have stop and go traffic on the freeways. And that change helped change the policy of the agency.
And so, Ms. Forlin, sometimes it's a determination of you know, what the public's needs are. Sometimes you're evaluating the dangerousness of a particular intersection or something like that. Is that how it works? And whether there's a need to put a stop light in at a particular intersection, or might that be one of the uses of this type of survey?
Madam Chair, it might be, although I'm not familiar that we've ever used that. One of the areas of safety that we have used it for is construction site safety and what works best with the public. What is most visible to the public when they're moving through? How frequently spaced should signs be so the average driver gets the safety message in the right amount of time? We also try to test our public opinion concerning our traveling information, how people are using the traveling information, and are we supplying enough at the rest stops or enough traveling information on our websites that's really helpful to people. I'm not aware that we used it on intersection signs on specific intersections.
So basically, Ms. Forsland, I guess what I would like to propose to this committee for its consideration is a compromise so that your department isn't prevented from obtaining useful information, and so that you don't have to when you're required to contact a certain number of people, so that you don't have to spend more money to contact more people. But that for those people who don't mind revealing identifying information, that we still have access to that information so that we can judge the credibility, or we might want to make there. I can think of a number of useful purposes for that information when attempts are made to analyze decisions that your agency is making. So I have the A1 amendment that council has drafted, and this may not be the right way to do it, but I have shared a copy of the amendment with the author. Or I have alternative language. If this is a direction that the committee is interested in thinking about, then we might want to look at even some alternative language as a different way to do this. But if the committee thinks that we should keep this information private, then I guess I just would be interested, I guess, in the members' reaction to whether there's a concern that we're completely shutting down the public's access to information that previously has been public, even in those situations where someone is agreeable with having that information made public? And maybe while the members are looking at this, Ms. Forsland, since you, I think, have a copy as well, I'm wondering if Senator Rest or Ms. Forsland would like to offer an opinion.
Madam Chair, I think this is the type of language that can be referred to as an opt-out kind of situation, where the person who is being surveyed would kind of have the options that you've expressed here. It would mean asking an additional question or two in the setup of interviews with them. Would you permit us to use your name and personal identifying information in our report results or something like that? Is that what you're envisioning? Am I getting that correct?
Yes, Ms. Forsland, I guess whatever mechanism we would use that would give someone the opportunity to make the choice so that we can keep information public to the extent that possible. I'm assuming that in the other cases where someone does not want the information made public, that you wouldn't get that information unless you gave the person that opportunity to keep the information private. And so that is an information that would be available to the public in any case. But in situations where the public doesn't, or where the subject doesn't object, we could keep that information public.
Madam Chair.
Senator Limmer.
If this is an opt-out, the premise is that all information collected would be available to the public unless that individual said no. That's the premise if it's an opt-out.
It's the only way.
An opt-in would be a different premise. Would be it would be considered all private unless the individual allows it to be public.
That's correct, Senator Limmer.
And this is an opt-out?
Well, it was my intention that it would be worded as an opt-out. And I have additional language. I was talking to Ms. Pontius beforehand. Another way we could put it is we could use the original language of the amendment and say that the data would be classified as public unless the subject of the survey requests that identifying data related to that subject be classified as private data on an individual. If such a request is made, the survey information shall be listed separately from the information containing identified information. So it was my intention, since this has historically been public data, to keep it public unless the person objects and wants the data made private.
Madam Chair.
Senator Rest.
Madam Chair, it would be the way in which the question was directed to the person being interviewed, whether unless they brought it up, that the information would be public, as opposed to saying to them, you have the option of having your name not associated with it, or your name associated with it. Which one do you want? I mean, it makes it a free choice, either so that it's both an opt-in and an opt-out, rather than an assumption that it is public data unless the interviewee raises some objection, and then the interviewer can say, oh, well, if you don't want it to be public, it doesn't have to be, as opposed to giving them the information that they can make a choice one way or the other.
And Senator Rest, I don't have a problem with giving the interviewee an option or a choice on the front end so that they understand they have that choice. And I'm sure we could word this to make that clear. Senator Limmer?
Madam Chair, Ms. Forsland, you stated in your earlier comments that sometimes the market research is asked of people whether or not, or what routes they may travel on a regular basis. Does it include, I suppose it can include a whole bunch of information, maybe what kind of car you drive? I think you mentioned that.
Yes.
I'm just trying to think of a more sinister use of this money, or not money, this information. I'm thinking too many appropriation bills. Let's say there was an individual who wanted to follow a young lady home. Let's say they can get this information out of a public record of where the person lives, what their telephone number is, what their name is, include the route that they drive home on, and even to the point of what kind of car they drive. That'll be public information now. And I think that's why we're so very careful in this state to protect privacy such as this. Now, we in the Department of, or in the driver license area of public safety, we had a long debate of whether or not we should protect information on just data on driver licenses as they pertain to a license plate. Now, if we continue going in this direction, public information that's held, I suppose we could reopen and repeal that law, but it'll have the same effect. And I think we have to be very cautious of how we open up these files as public data. I have always preferred, if there's going to be any type of opt-in or opt-out, I prefer an opt-in. But I wouldn't want to support anything that reveals the names or addresses or driving routes or any other piece of information that may tie an individual to a pattern of behavior where someone else may take advantage. And we've had those instances in criminal history in the state of Minnesota where that has exactly happened.
Well, Senator Limmer, I recognize your concern, and I think that's what makes this committee and the debates we'll have in this committee, there's always that balancing or that weighing of interests, because on the one hand, the reason we have laws that require the government to make information public is so that as government entities, we can be held accountable, and the decisions we make that can be examined by the public. This is public information now, and so we're looking at whether to make this. I'm looking for feedback on that balance. And Senator Moy,
Madam Chair, Ms. Forslund, maybe you could give us a. And maybe I just wasn't listening. To it. What is the context of the market research? And then what are the subsequent uses of the information from the market research? Is that used just within the department what are the subsequent uses? And then I guess my follow-up question to that would be, is this information ultimately then sold to third-party vendors or made available to others who would like to purchase the information that has been gathered by the department?
Madam Chair and Senator Wan, the context that the market research is performed in begins with a business question that the agency needs to answer. The development of that business question would remain public information. Once the question is phrased, the market research professionals determine which method of market research will yield an answer to the question. So we covered a wide range of things. We asked citizens, for instance, when a budget crunch came forward, how did they feel about roadside mowing compared to some other services? And we got a very clear message that they really didn't care about roadside mowing. Finances were tough, and if we had to make a choice, they gave us clear direction where to make that choice. Those results were shared with MnDOT management, who fed that information into how they structured the resources of MnDOT. So the context for each research project is probably different. We've tracked feelings of people as best as market research can. Are they safe in a construction zone? Are they feeling safe as they're driving on a certain highway? We have also figured a community construction evaluation project that gathered public opinion regarding construction projects and built a best practices for how to relate to communities when construction projects are underway. We did some research on MinPass to determine what we thought the reception would be for that program, and that program has followed through and been successful. So our research was accurate. The context is internal to MnDOT. None of the results have been sold or intended to be sold. Again, we're going back to those professional ethics of the market research industry and MnDOT's policies about that sort of thing. We would not ever sell the results. It's not anything that is of much interest to the rest of the world because there are specific business questions that we're seeking to answer.
Senator Moore.
Madam Chair, Ms. Forslund, so really the repackaging of the information is when the market researcher comes back and puts the analysis together, and where the information would then be exchanged is within MnDOT as each layer of individuals are meeting and working and reporting to peoples in positions of decision-making. And ultimately, some of that information might end up here at the legislature as we ask you for the information. But ultimately, this information wouldn't be available for somebody to purchase if they wanted to purchase a specific set of information for maybe some other purposes, for some other purposes.
Ms. Forslund?
Madam Chair and Senator, a great deal of the information will be public, and anyone is welcome to summary data, which would be all of the information purged of the individual names and identifications. So a member of the public could get a copy of our analytical report and could see MnDOT's next steps, because part of market research at the end of the operation is to help MnDOT shape who next gets the information and what needs to be done. If there need to be focused group discussions about an issue within MnDOT, market research will help direct that as well. And all of that information would be available publicly, but it's not packaged in a way that's marketable.
Senator Best.
Thank you, Madam Chair. But currently, looking at the, going back to the scenario of chain of information, right now, as I understand it, when that information gets to the legislature, you, Senator Moore, could ask for individual identification of every single person who had responded so that you could know how many of them were your constituents. And having that information, because it's available on demand, you could then contact your constituents who had responded to this market survey, or you, Senator Limmer, on MnPass, or me, and I could contact those people. And, boy, to go to the expense, and it looks like from their data that it costs 30% more to get those individual people to agree to have their names available to you, no cost, on demand, is not ethical. And perhaps someone is able to say, it's okay if Senator Limmer knows my name, or you, or any of the rest of us, and the information that MnDOT brings forward, but it would, I think it's wrong.
Senator Moore.
Madam Chair, I appreciate the depth to which we are engaging in this discussion about this information, because it is critical information. But the longer I've listened to, you know, and participated in this discussion, I guess the more comfortable I've become with the language that's in Subdivision 14. And the reason why I appreciate that is because perhaps I wouldn't ask for the names and addresses of the respondents who are from 55119, but I would want to know perhaps, of the 1,000 people who were surveyed and who responded, how many of that 1,000 were from that certain zip code, to just get me a sense of maybe help alert me to where maybe those individuals are. So in retrospect, I guess I do like the idea of leaving the zip codes there as a marker and identifier. But I like the idea of making the other identifiers, you know, non-public information. Because I think there is a certain value to giving MnDOT or our the department, or for that matter, any agency that engages in projects, you know, of a caliber, of a level that MnDOT does. Hopefully, we would want them to go out there, not spend a ton of money for, you know, the public opinion, because in part we would hope that they would engage in the conversation with us in helping to identify some of those priorities. But certainly where there is controversy or where there is a desire to identify a direction to focus resources, I think that it would be valuable to try to give some protection to respondents so that we can get some indicator of what would be good policy priorities. So I am comfortable with Subdivision 14 based on the information that we've received.
Thank you, Senator Moore. And I think the compromise I was suggesting would eliminate the need to spend that extra 30%, because we would still be able to use that information, so there shouldn't have been an increased cost. But I think that was what I was hoping we could do, is have some discussion about this issue, and that I could get a feeling from the other members. And unless Senator Betzold wants to weigh in differently on this issue, I think I'll just leave well enough alone on that section then. Senator Limmer?
Oh, I think you were looking for a response. Okay. I had a question to Madam Chair, to Senator Ress. Senator Ress, could I direct you to, again, I still hadn't gotten a definition on overhead rate. We kind of drifted from that request, but...
Senator Limmer, if we're going to move on from that issue, then, did you want...
I'm
there
sorry.
Was... We
I
had a...
withdrew your amendment.
Oh, yes, but just it had to do with that section. And I guess what I was thinking is, if we've moved past that issue, you had a question about that, and but there was someone here who could address that, did you say?
Madam Chair, the director of our audit department is here, Mr. Dan Conkey, and he is a technical expert on the overhead rate, and he also has supporting staff with him. If you would like to hear from him, I'd like to bring him forward now.
Thank you. And Senator Limmer, then I think he can address this issue for you.
As he's coming forward, though, it is very common practice in proposals for grants, et cetera, to include a pre-established overhead rate that is attached to the grant. For example, university researchers who make applications to the National Institutes of Health, for example, the University of Minnesota has an overhead rate that has to be added to the grant application for the total cost of the grant coming back, because the university will be providing administrative help and this and that and the other thing, and often it's like 150% of the cost of the grant is the overhead rate. And every university, for example, has a different overhead rate when it's making applications. And the department has an overhead rate of 150, did you say? 155. And what they do is get all that information together to see whether or not that contractor in making a bid meets that rate, because if they go over it, too bad. They only get 155.
I'm sure.
Okay. Senator Limmer?
I think I got a good enough explanation just by that.
Yeah, but I mean, unless I hadn't got it wrong.
I had never heard overhead considered as a rate before, and just overhead is how I would parlance would use it. So,
Mr. Conkey, is there anything you'd like to add to that explanation?
Madam Chair, the rate is a calculation. So basically, it's the indirect costs divided by the direct labor base, and that percent becomes the overhead rate. And the term overhead rate is a federal term that's in all the federal regulations. And that's how and why it's used.
Madam Chair.
Senator Limmer.
One question I wanted to ask of Senator Rest. Senator Rest, if I could direct your attention to page 1, line 18. There's a qualifying statement to this data, and the qualifier is financial statements and lists of stockholders provided to the commissioner by a consultant. Does the words by a consultant need to be there? It qualifies this bit of information, and wouldn't it just be any financial statements and lists provided to the commissioner? And does anyone really need to know where it came from?
Madam Chair and Senator Limmer, this is in the sections of the statutes that deal with consultants specifically. So that's why you don't have the language on either side of this. It's just adding a section dealing with consultants in terms of their overhead rate data.
Madam Chair, if Senator, there was financial statements and lists of stockholders provided to the commissioner, but not by a consultant, let's say they gathered that information from another source, then would that not be considered non-public or private data?
Senator Rest?
I think Ms. Forslund indicated at the beginning, public corporations, lists of shareholders there, there is an avenue to obtain that information. The folks that are proposed to be listed here, and I do believe that the correct term is shareholder, not stockholder, are those that are more than likely to be small, closely held corporations where what the interest is not the names of the people involved, but the volatility of stock transactions, how many of them hold, how much, so that they can determine in the overhead rate calculations that they're making just how reliable this company is going to be, and that's one piece of information. But they really don't need the names of the people. They just need to know what kinds of, well, I guess they don't need to make public the names of the people, but they're looking for the activity of the group, the entity, the corporation, the partnership, for that matter, that would reflect on whether or not this is a reasonable company to give a bid to, give a contract to. Ms. Forslund has something to add.
Okay. And then Senator Betzold has a question.
Madam Chair and Senator, the reason we included the words by a consultant in there is that at MnDOT, we have these two major types of activity, construction contracts and consultant contracts, and it's easy to confuse them. Now, this overhead rate applies only to consultant contracts, and so we thought it was important to make that clear so no one would misunderstand and think we were trying to include construction contracts, which most of the time are handled by opening a sealed bid and the contractor figures their overhead whatever way they figure it in their developing their bid. So we wanted to make sure we never had confusion about that and that we were trying to limit this just to consultant contracts. And that's why we thought we needed it there.
Senator Moy, I guess, had a question, and then Senator Betzold had a question.
Mr. Conkey, you, Madam Chair, Mr. Conkey, you had define overhead rate as sort of a formula of a numerator and denominator equaling a result. And my understanding is that the result is public, but it is really the formula, it's the numerator and the denominator that we want to protect because that's the competitive edge that each of the bids come in with. We want to protect the numerator, the denominator that led to the result. Is that right?
Mr. Conkey?
Madam Chair, that's correct. it's the indirect costs, and there's a lot of different things that go into an indirect cost. And you could have bonuses and distribution of profit, and that's that stuff we knock out, and that's all part of the calculation too. But the last calculation we make is we take all the allowable indirect costs and divide it by the direct labor base, and that is the rate. But it's a calculation and all those costs that are potentially damaging to the firm if their competitors got a hold of it, we want to protect.
And then, Madam
Senator
Chair
Ma?
And Ms. Forslund, I just want to how does the information in this type of a bid process for consultants, the information that we're asking for to be kept private here, compare with other information, and you raised the construction contracts in some other areas at the department that we choose to keep as private information. Is there a parallel? I mean, are we asking for brand new things here to be kept private? Is it this highly unusual, or in some other areas in the department, are we also keeping financial statements and, you know, shareholders and things like that also private to protect the competitive edge of the people who are competing?
Ms. Forslund?
Madam Chair and Senator, I'm not aware that we gather this information anywhere else at the agency. So this is the special uniqueness of this situation.
Thank you.
Senator Betzel?
Thank you. Madam Chair, Mr. Conkey and Ms. Forslund, on page 1, line 17, if we were to change the – and Senator Rest – if we were to change the term list of stockholders to – change that to shareholder financial data. Is that the information you're trying to protect?
Ms. Conkey?
Yes, I believe that's exactly what we're trying to protect.
Okay. Madam Chair, then I will move on page 1, line 17, strike lists of stockholders and insert shareholder financial data.
Senator Betzold has moved that on line 1.17 we strike lists of stockholders and insert shareholder financial data. All those in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, nay.
Madam Chair.
Senator Rest.
By adoption of that amendment, that could still include protecting the names of the, I mean, part of the shareholder financial data include the name of the shareholder or not?
Senator Rest, I understood the amendment that the name would be still public, but that the financial data would be private. Is that your intention, Senator Betzel?
Madam Chair, I believe so, because as I understood the testimony, the lists include names plus a lot of other information. And to the extent that it reveals the financial information, I don't know that that needs to be public.
And Senator Betzold, I agreed with your amendment or voted in favor of it because I think that allows the public to still determine whether there might be some kind of conflict of interest or some reason where they need to know that, but it doesn't disclose the private information that might cause a financial hardship.
Correct.
Senator Rest,
you did it, so it's on there.
Madam Chair.
Senator Limmer.
Madam Chair, what would be the – I'm trying to catch up to this discussion as far as why would we not want to protect the identity of this individual? And what is the conflict of interest that we're talking about?
Well, Madam Chair, if there's a question,
Senator Betzel,
I'd be happy to move to reconsider if we want to have further discussion on this issue.
Senator Rest, would you like to? We can reconsider if you'd like to weigh in on this.
I was just, it's up to the committee. I was just asking the question about whether that included the name or not, and Senator Betzel indicated that it would not protect the name.
But,
so that's just an answer to a question.
Sure.
Okay. Senator Betzel.
And I have Ms. Forslund. I said, are we trying to protect the financial data? And she said, yes, that's exactly what it is. So that's why I made the amendment as I did. After I'd asked a couple of times, what, you know, segregate the names from the financial data. So, you know, I'm trying to figure out what we're trying to protect here.
Ms. Forslund, did you want to respond to that?
Chair and Senator, clearly I misunderstood your intent because my assumption was it was the name and the percentage that they owned. I was incorrect.
Okay.
Very sorry for that. Mr. Conkey may have an opinion as to why names might be.
Okay, I'll move to reconsider the vote by which the amendment was adopted.
All those in favor of reconsidering the motion, say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Okay.
And now, Madam Chair.
Senator Betzel.
Let me ask the question that I've asked a couple of times, and I'd like to get an answer on it. Please don't talk about the financial data. Is what reason do we have to not disclose the names of the shareholders?
Mr. Conkey?
I guess it's a moot point when it comes to a publicly held corporation. That information is just simply out there. It's the privately held firms that do not wish to have that information available for public consumption. And these would be companies or firms that are really closely held, like family members or husband and wife type scenarios. And they just simply will not do business with the Department of Transportation knowing that all that information is now available for public consumption. And our concern is some of these companies are very well-run companies. They do wonderful work, yet they won't do business with us because of this. Everything they give us now is now public. And there are times when we've had to go to another company that was publicly held, and the product may not have been as good, and it might have cost more. And this is our concern is we want to get the best price and the best product for the money.
Senator Betzel.
Mr. Conkey, you just said everything they give us is now public. And I just said, my question is, and I'll repeat it again, the names. Okay, now, you may think that you want to protect the names of them. That's fine. And if there's anybody out there who wants to weigh in on this, I'd like to hear from that.
Senator Betzel,
Madam Chair,
there is that someone who wants to weigh in on this issue. Actually, I think Mr. Neumeister wants to testify to this issue.
Madam Chair, I'm getting frustrated. Thank you.
Madam Chair, members of the subcommittee, are we talking about the bill itself, or are we just talking about Section 2?
At this point, Mr. Neumeister, we're just focusing on Section 2.
Mr. Chairman, members of the subcommittee, I don't see.
For the record, would you state your name, please?
My name is Rich Neumeister. For the compelling public interest, I do not see why Vista stockholders need to be non-public. One of the concerns I have is that this is a consultant is getting this. It could be over a bridge. It could be whatever the consultant does. And one of the concerns I have is interlocking relationships, who gets what, you know, different kinds of situations. So at least with the issue about listed stockholders, I would like to see that remain public. Madam Chair, members of the committee, thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Neumeister. What is the wish of the members? Senator Betzel, do you want to renew your motion?
I renew my motion, Madam Chair, that the shareholder financial strike lists of stockholders and put shareholder financial data.
Okay. Senator Betzel renews his motion that on line 1.17, we strike lists of stockholders and insert shareholder financial data. All those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Those opposed? Motion passes.
Thank you.
Members, is there anyone else in the audience that wishes to testify on this bill?
Madam Chair,
Senator Betzel?
One more question. I had asked on page 2, line 4, it says any data on individuals are classified. Okay. I think that's rather broad. I just wonder if we could I mean, counsel's help on this one. Maybe financial data on individuals that are classified?
Well, and Senator Betzel, that raises a point that I had concern about as well, because I think the rationale given for not revealing or for the new language in this bill was that there's certain information in here that should be protected under data privacy. But it seems to me that this language is very broad and encompasses not only the language that should be protected, but a lot of additional public information. And so, again, I guess in terms of this committee's wishes, whether we want to prevent the public from having access to more information than we need. Senator Moore?
Madam Chair, though, I want to be respectful of the process, and I don't know very much about this area. I'm just going back to what was testified to, which is my understanding is that the bid documentation, which encompasses all the writings, the working papers, the computer printouts, and all other data calculations used by a contractor to determine its bid and bidding for a contract, that this information is somehow locked up somewhere and sealed. And so if that's the case, then in essence, aren't we, because the process is so sealed, if we make any of that information available to the public, aren't we violating the intent of the process, is to keep it kind of sealed away, escrowed and sealed away somewhere? Ms. Forslund, am I misunderstanding your explanation on this section?
Madam Chair and Senator, I'm not quite sure I understand your question. This data has a relationship to the proposal data that comes in and is opened when we open bids. It's not the same as, but it is a relationship to. It's possible that this information would include information about other subcontractors that were contacted who did not have equipment available, as opposed to the final one that made it in. In other words, there might be justifications for what we call our line items in the bids. Now, the line items in the bids eventually become public. Once a project is awarded, you can see what the prime contractor figured for all of its supplies and all that, and you can see what the unsuccessful bidders figured for all of those same things. So this data is related to that, but is different and can include things such as key employee names that they might want to keep secret. In other words, it's a competitive field out there to find people who can operate certain pieces of equipment or who can speak certain languages while they're four people on a construction site. Contractors try to keep that private because that's the nature of their business. So there could be other data on individuals in there. So any data was intended to include all of that, and it is a kind of companion piece to all the technical data that's included in there. I don't know if that helped you work your way through the question, Senator.
Senator Betzel, I should also make this committee aware. Is there anyone here in the audience from AFSCME? I think that AFSCME also wants to weigh in on this bill. This might be it before you. Okay. So could we have the AFSCME representative testify at this point? Please identify yourself for the record.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm Julie Blyle, Legislative Director for AFSCME Council 5. And we have concerns, particularly with Section 3, Subdivision 16. Our members have brought to us a concern that many times work is contracted out and they believe that they are able to do the work for less cost. And their concern is now we're making private that data. And whether that be folks that work in the design area prior to a design build construction project going forward, they've done work on that project. They feel threatened. I think many of the employees at DOT feel threatened from the standpoint that they've been downsized to a point where they feel that contractors and privatization has taken over. So that's their concern with this section, because now we're making more data private rather than public, and they feel it should be, since it's taxpayers' dollars, that this information should be available to the public. I'll just throw out a suggestion here for a change, and it would be on line 2.4, beginning bid documentation held in escrow by the Department of Transportation, after the word transportation, insert accepted bids is classified as except the accepted bid. So the final bid would remain public, which would then give something for our members to look at in comparison. Thank you.
Members, do we have any, or Senator Rest?
Madam Chair, I don't think that's the issue with the bid documentation. As I understand it, and I'm certainly new to this area as well, but the bid documentation is provided after a contract has been awarded, so that it shows later on if there is a dispute over some issue in the contract, the department can say, okay, you say that you did all this and it was in the documentation of the bid. A contract has already been awarded, okay. Show us. And they say, okay, let's open up the big documentation box and we will show you that we are right in this dispute that we're having with you, because we have historical data that went into the bid that shows that this is exactly the way that we had information that we had based our bid on. The current practice is for indeed this information to be locked away, and it's only available on a limited basis to members of the department. This is the current practice, not talking about the statute, only available on a limited basis to members of the department when a dispute arises. Now, otherwise, of course, the information is available under subpoena. I mean, it's there, but and they can, you know, by court order be required to make the data available. But it's only used now after, okay, you win the contract, you have to put the bid documentation in a box, and only if there's a dispute about some element of the contract is it ever referred to. I'm very sympathetic to the notion of we want public employees doing the work for a Department of Transportation, and not unduly and inappropriately set aside for some private contractor. But that's not what the thrust of this information is here.
Senator Moore.
Madam Chair and Senator Rest, I think that I agree with you. And in fact, I don't think that sentence with respect to on line 2.4 to 2.5, any data individuals in the bid documentation are classified as private data individuals, I don't think you even need that here, because this section talks about bid documentation that's being held in escrow. And then there's a definition of what bid documentation is. And so if your explanation is correct, then as part of the defined bid documentation, if there's information in there about a certain special, you know, person or someone or whatever, that would be part of the writings and the paperwork and the charts and the computer printouts of whatever is in the bundle of bid documentation. So I don't really think you need that second sentence to make special provisions about individuals.
Madam Chair, Senator Moore, I think the reason why the department put that language in there is because, as Ms. Ponte has said before, we classify information on individuals as persons, as private data, and information that we want to protect that's on non-human beings is called non-public data, but it's the same level of protection, and that's the only, that's the reason why it's there.
Okay. Senator Mott, does that satisfy you?
Yes.
Okay. So I'd now like to ask Ms. Blyle, having heard the explanation from Senator Rust, in terms of how this data is used and existing practice, whether that satisfies the concerns that AFSCME has with regard to this bill.
Mr. Chairman, with all due respect, it doesn't satisfy the concerns because our members have concerns about the work they're currently doing, and that work could be in the form of a subcontract that would be in the form of your definition of bid documentation. And unless we know what the amount is on the final bid, we don't have access to that information. We have nothing to compare it to, and that's been their concern all along.
Senator Rust, is that information available now? Or is this making a change with respect to that?
I really do think it's apples and oranges. I don't think that that's the issue here. But I'm not going to tell my good friend here that, you know, she's wrong, but I don't see it as on point. That's all.
Well, Madam Chair, let me use an example.
Okay. Ms. Blyle.
It gets back to the design folks. Those are the ones that keep contacting us with concerns. And the work that they do could be put into a subcontract within the definition, and therefore that work could be contracted out. And it's not just their area, but I'll use them as the example. We will never know what the state paid per hour or per project, for that matter, within that, unless that information is public. And the only way that we could see to get at it was to insert that the final bid that the department accepts is public. There may be a better way to get at that issue, but that was the only suggestion that we had to be able to bring the data forward to make it public.
Senator Rust, I believe that this bill, and I'm not sure how the other members feel about this bill overall, if it's your desire to move this forward to judiciary, but I'm just wondering if it would be possible for there, if this is apples and oranges, is there a way to work out the discrepancy here to satisfy everyone's needs? Senator Moore?
Madam Chair, the department is here. I think that we should get a response to that question. I think that on projects where the final bid has taken place, where if we want historical information and analysis of who's participating, the information about the awarding of a bid, of a contract, I believe that information, once the contract has been granted, that then becomes public information. And I'd like a response to that, because I think, and if that's not the case, then we'll have a separate orange conversation outside of this apple conversation. But I'd like a response to that.
Hey, Ms. Parker.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm Betsy Parker from MnDOT. I think that there's a fundamental misunderstanding about the purpose of Subdivision 16. Subdivision 16 relating to bid escrow data applies solely to MnDOT construction contracts, contracts that we have always, for decades, had all done by the private sector. MnDOT does no work where we do our own construction jobs, except maybe pothole patching and the very most basic kind of road repair. But this does not apply to professional technical contracts, which I think is what AFSCME is mostly worried about, because in fact all of the design for highway projects that is done not by MnDOT employees but by contractors, is done through professional technical contracts under Chapter 16C in Minnesota statutes. Now, I think that AFSCME is also concerned about design-build contracts, of which we have let five since 2002, I believe. We do roughly 200 or more construction contracts a year. So in the last 5 years, that would be close to 1,000 contracts. Only five of those have been design-build. Those are the only kind of contracts that MnDOT would have that would be affected by this language that would affect design done by AFSCME employees. This section deals only with construction contracts and not with professional technical contracts that we would normally use to obtain design services from a consulting engineering firm. That is not addressed here.
Okay. Senator Ma.
Madam Chair and Ms. Parker, I am satisfied with that response. But I have to tell you that I know that this is not the Transportation Committee. But as a member of the Transportation Committee, this is not the first time, and I don't think it will be the last time, that individuals, first it was DEB businesses, and now AFSCME, raising concerns about the bid process, about who's getting these contracts, and raising concerns about not only DEB businesses raising the concerns, but now we have AFSCME raising that concern. And so I understand that this may be above your pay grade, but I hope that you'll receive the message that at least this member on the Transportation Committee is concerned about that, and I think that we will have to engage in that conversation, that orange conversation, in a different context.
Thank you, Ms. Parker. And Ms. Blyle, would you do you want to weigh in one last time on the comment that was made before we make a decision on this bill?
It's public now.
Madam Chair.
Oh, Senator Rest.
High risk. I think we're done.
Oh, we're done? Is there anyone else in the audience who wanted to testify on this bill?
Except for Rich.
Mr. Chairman, Madam Chair, members of the subcommittee, there were two other points of the bill.
First, identify yourself for the record.
For the record, my name is Rich Neumeister. On the first section, I don't see the compelling interest to make a half and half kind of thing, half private, half public. I contend the compelling public interest is all public. So I suggest that basically do away with Section 1. I'm handing out front sheets of the rest area survey, the ramp meter survey, a marketing implementation plan of advanced traveler information. One of the things that MnDOT has done over the years is say, the public in Minnesota say this, let's march. So they come to the legislature and ask for millions of dollars or whatever to do different things. These are just three examples of surveys. I think it's important when a public agency relies on surveys to direct things, it needs to be public if anyone wants to go look at it. And that's my point. I don't see a compelling public interest to make it what you're proposing. The third item, the thing is, I believe the bids should be sealed. But bids are open in the third section when there's a disagreement between the main contractor and the person who the main contractor talks to about wages, prices, or whatever it might be. That's when the escrow data should be open to the public. Because those disagreements that may be between the contractor and who's ever doing some of the other kinds of work may increase the price of something down the pike, what MnDOT does on construction or whatever. I think it's in the compelling public interest, at least at that time, in that specific situation, when MnDOT staff needs to open that sealed bid, then it all should become public on that specific situation.
Thank you, Mr. Neumeister. Senator Rest, do you want to offer any response to those comments?
Well, as usual, I think Mr. Neumeister always presents an interesting point of view. I think he's wrong on the first part. And I think, again, it's not the kind of the bid information data that we're talking about is held in escrow now, and it is the purpose of it is to provide a historical basis for resolving disputes. That's the purpose of it. And the overall bid, as far as I know, that's public data now. It's not, this is sort of stuff that would go, that would be dealt with to provide a factual basis for resolving disputes.
Thank you, Senator Rest. Anyone want to move the bill?
Madam Chair, if there's no other comments, I'll move that the just to be clear on the procedure, I believe that your bill, Senate File 596, is going to be the vehicle for the omnibus bill.
That's correct, Senator Betzel.
And there may or may not be other meetings after tonight. We don't know. But the Senate has until about mid-April, I guess, to wrap up its policy bill. So I will move that the contents of Senate File 1166, as amended, be incorporated into the omnibus bill, Senate File 596.
Senator Betzold has moved that Senate File 1166, as amended, be incorporated into the omnibus bill. All those in favor, say aye.
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 Opposed? Nay. Nay. Motion passes.
Yep.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Come back anytime.
Thank you, Senator Rest.
Was that a motion? That's a motion.
That works.
Okay. We're next going to hear Senator Betzold's bill. This is
1142.
Did she do one? Oh, okay, that's fine. She did one.
That's right. This is
Madam Chair.
Senator Limmer.
I was quietly trying to explain to Senator Moi that we spent an hour and a half on the first bill. I think we have five bills total, and I just wanted to say to you, since you're new, welcome to what is affectionately known in the Senate as the cult.
Yeah. Madam Chair, it's also referred to as a subcommittee from hell.
Something in health and human service.
Well, Senator Limmer, as far as I know right now, we have four bills in data practices, and that's all. So if we were to finish all four tonight, we would be done with everything that's come to data practices so far. So we may not finish them all tonight, but the good news is that the last two, the ones I'm carrying, I think, as far as I know, are not controversial. So
That's what they always say,
Madam Chair.
Madam Chair, I don't think Senator Rest thought her bill was controversial when she walked into the room tonight.
Oh, you're not. You're young.
Senator Betzold.
Madam Chair, the stories of this subcommittee are legend. First of all, I do have an A1 amendment that the shape that I desire. It's an author's amendment, and I hope would ask that it be distributed. And then I would move the A1 amendment.
Senator Betzold, we have the A1 amendment in front of us. Senator Betzold moves the A1 amendment. All those in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion passes.
Madam Chair, there are still some issues that need to be resolved with this, but let me just point out, first of all, that this bill originated before the amendment as a Department of Labor and Industry bill. There's a number of issues that just in the broad context that they've been trying to resolve for quite a while. A lot of their information, because they do workers' comp appeals and a lot of medical data, they identify individuals by their Social Security number, and because of more sensitivity, particularly those types of data, they've tried to find ways to kind of limit the public access to particularly those two areas. I'll briefly go through the bill. We've got Ms. Pontius's summary A. The first four sections are just cross-references. Basically, within the Data Practices Act, we used to put everything in the Data Practices Act. We've since moved things out so that, but there'd be cross-references if you try to find something, maybe in the substantive area law or maybe Chapter 13, but we do try to cross-reference back and forth. And basically, the first four sections simply do that. Now, some of this actually gets a little bit beyond what is within the purview of this committee, and I'm having to work out whether or not this bill might have to, we might have to keep some portions within this committee and the full committee and then have other committees look at it. I'm not sure, but Section 5 actually is not a data issue. It just talks about the hearings that are currently open to the public, and Workers' Comp Division would not be open to the public. Now, that's not a data issue, but that is an issue. Section 6, we do have a provision in law that allows agencies to charge a reasonable fee for copying files. This would set the fee at 65 cents per page. Now, that's a bit higher than what other agencies and the Department of Labor and Industry can comment on that, because they're basically a repository for a lot of records that a lot of people want to get copies of. Just as a matter of policy, we do not want agencies to be making money off of policies. We want to make it accessible and reasonable cost, but we do recognize that there are costs in doing this, and so that is something, and whether 65 cents is the right one or not remains to be seen. In Section 7, you can see that there's a number of provisions in this thing. I will point to you, for instance, on page 3, line 21, that data on an individual who makes a complaint with the department would be protected, but it may be released, if you look on page, on line 28, page 3, that the identity person might be released if the department maintains data in the employee's workers' compensation division file. Again, the department can discuss that. There are references to confidential data, that is data that does not have to be disclosed the subject of that. You can see on line 33 that's non-public during an investigation, and typically with investigative data, it's typically not public. But I'll have the department go through more specifics in this. In Section 8, we're striking some disclosure provisions on misdemeanor penalties for persons who supply the names of information. Section 9 is data sharing of Social Security information between government agencies. And this is typical what we've done in other areas where we some agencies have to share information back and forth. And there's a traveling data requirement. That is, if it's private within one agency, it has to be private within the agency that's shared. Section 10 is a cross-reference. And then Section 11 strikes a reference to medical records being open to public. Let me turn it over to the department representative for further discussion on this. And as I say, there is a lot of information. And, Madam Chair, I recognize that we don't want to spend, you know, if we can resolve all the issues tonight, we can. But I'm prepared to, you know, kind of continue discussion if need be. But
thank you, Senator. Thank you, Senator Betzold. And your first witness?
Nancy Lepinkin. I'm the Director of Legal Services with the Department of Labor and Industry.
Ms. Lepig?
Would you like me just to start at the top?
Sure. If you'd like to just go through the bill and point out the areas that you want to focus on.
As Senator Betzold indicated, the first four sections are simply cross-references. So really you can go to page 2.25. Sorry, I just had a draft that looked different from this draft, so excuse me. Because there is a... I'd like to point you to line 2.23, actually, because there's an error in that portion of the bill where there's a reference to 170 on line 2.23. There's a reference to 175.40, and that was to a part of the bill that's no longer in the bill, the original version of the bill, and that so therefore that should be deleted. and a period put after subdivision 3?
Yeah, Madam Chair, I'll make that motion, and
okay.
That on page 2, line 23, put a period after subdivision 3 and then strike the rest of the line.
Senator Betzold moves that on page 2, line 23, a period should be inserted after subdivision 3, and the remainder of the sentence should be stricken. All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Those opposed? Motion passes.
Regarding line 2.28 on page 2, Senator Betzel's correct that hearings, you know, technically aren't data. The issue here is that the department no longer holds hearings, and consequently that provision is obsolete, and to the extent that then the last sentence says all the proceedings of the division shall be shown on its records, which are public, that provision is inconsistent and in conflict with other provisions of law, both in the Data Practices Act and in Chapter 176. And so, therefore, that's why we're proposing that it be repealed.
Ms. Lepping, again, I don't know that this is a discussion we want to be having in this committee, but aren't these hearings done? You said you don't hold hearings anymore?
Senator Olson, the department, the hearing authority of the department was moved to the Office of Administrative Hearings. And so consequently, at this point, we don't hold hearings as was the case when this language was drafted.
So, Ms. Lepping, are you saying that we're not really making any change in policy? We're just eliminating language that no longer has an application?
Yes, it no longer has an application, correct. And we basically deleted line 1 because it works sort of in tandem with the other sentence that's deleted. But if it's outside the purview of the committee, we can always resurrect the hearings of the Workers' Compensation Division are open to the public and may be adjourned from time to time, but then simply delete the last sentence if that would be preferable.
Well, Senator Moore.
Well, Madam Chair, if they're no longer doing that and the authority has been moved, this is basically a technical correction.
Yeah.
I don't have an issue.
Okay. Then in that case, I think we won't need to spend any time on that, and we can leave that in.
Moving on to line 2.33, the department has had a long-standing practice since it became the official repository of workers' compensation data that relates to an employee's claim or injury. So to charge a copy fee that covered the actual costs of providing that service. So for the department, we are the repository of data, much of which really is not collected by the department for our administrative or enforcement purposes, but because the legislature has designated us as the official repository of the record and all matters relating to an employee's claim. Consequently, we are the source of that data for the Office of Administrative Hearings, for the Workers' Compensation Court of Appeals, for the agency, for all persons who are parties to any litigation or action that's related to the employee's claim. And consequently, there's very high demand for this data, and that currently the department has staff that this is providing copies of this data is their job. And the department has calculated that the cost of providing that service, the actual cost, is 65 cents per page.
Well, members, I don't know if we want to address these questions or issues as we go through the bill. Actually, that might be, in my opinion, a better way to do it, because if we don't get through the bill, we'll have at least addressed these issues as they come up. And Ms. Lepping, I would have to question or take issue with the fact that it costs 65 cents a page to copy these documents. Over the last number of years, actual costs of retrieving documents has become less expensive with new technology, much less expensive, in fact, not more expensive. Even when you build in the cost of a copier, they cost about a tenth of what they used to for the same type of equipment, 10 or 15 years ago. And when you build these costs in, you're passing the cost of public records or private records, whatever these may be, but you're passing that cost on to consumers or citizens. Now, I understand there's some time involved in retrieving these records. And that to compensate for that time, if you only have to copy one page or two pages, that might be more expensive or more justifiable to charge a little bit more. But when you have to charge 200 or when you have to copy 200 pages on the same case, the cost of copying all those records is not going to amount to 65 cents a page. And so, again, I don't know how the other members feel, but Ms. Pontius has drafted some language for me that would allow you to charge 65 cents a page for the first 10 pages that a person requests, but thereafter that the charge would be reduced to 25 cents, which is still quite a bit more than a person pays when they go into any kind of the public services that we have available and pay for copying. Senator Moore.
Madam Chair and Ms. Lepnick, and I don't know, maybe you don't have this information, but when you set this price, this is just based on the cost to you, or did you have the ability to survey a little bit about what other agencies who provide copies would also be are charging?
Ms. Lepnick?
Senator Olson, Senator Mua. It's my understanding that the 65 cents a page is based on our financial director's determination of the number of staff that's required on a full-time basis to respond to these data requests, the cost of the copy machine, the cost of the paper, to provide these copies. The demand in the agency is sufficient that we have several full-time staff that this is all they do. They retrieve the data, they copy the data, they get the data to the party who's requested it. And so consequently, the 65 cents is based on literally the actual cost to the agency of providing this service.
Yeah. Senator Moore.
Madam Chair, Ms. Lepnick, so we're not, when we say it only costs 10 cents to make a copy at Kinko's, I mean, literally there, we're just talking about the piece of paper and the ink that runs in the machine. But what you're saying is that the 65 cents is the sort of the labor cost of the individual getting the request, walking somewhere, sorting through the files, taking out the files, and bringing the file somewhere, making that copy, bundling it up, and sending it to somebody? I mean, is that what this all encompasses?
Yes. And understand that most of the time people want this data immediately. They want to come in. It's a lawyer. It's a judge. And so therefore they don't want to wait to come in, come back tomorrow. They need the data for purposes of litigation. Typically, it's in that context. Insurance companies access it, employers access it, employees access it, but primarily their legal counsel accesses it. And consequently, to have the kind of turnaround time and to meet the demand that there is for this data requires that kind of staff.
Senator Moyle.
Madam Chair and Ms. Lepnick, and usually it's not the entire file. It's they're asking for specific types of information that's in the file. So you have to kind of sort through the file.
Ms. Lepnick?
Senator Mua, it can be a variety. It also can be, often employees have multiple dates of injury, so it can be multiple files that they want access to. Now, I have a lot of the data is we have an image database system. So therefore, but we also have files that are very old that have not been imaged. So sometimes it's a matter. Often claims can go for tens of years, and there's a need. So for example, if someone has a work comp injury when they're 20 and it's aggravated when they're 40, then the claim that they had when they're 20 is relevant to the claim that they have when they're 40. For purposes of liability. And so consequently, there'll be a need by the insurer, the employer, the employee to not only retrieve all the documents, and this is all of the documents. These are pleadings. These are depositions. These are briefs. These are motions, and in addition to voluminous medical records that can be part of a work comp file, independent medical counsel. It can be interveners who are coming in to get their part of the settlement, providers, rehab providers, pharmacies.
Ms. Lepping, I think we get the,
okay,
the
so
idea. But let me ask you this, Ms. Lepping. In terms of this information, this 65 cents would be considerably higher than any other government administrative agency is charging for records at the present time. Isn't 25 cents more the standard cost or standard charge?
I can't speak, Senator Olson, I can't speak to how other agencies have calculated the cost and the circumstances as to what kind of data and what demand there is for that data. All I can say is that the agency is very careful about what it charges. It's not making money on this proposition. This money is dedicated solely to the cost, and the amount up until now is adjusted depending on exactly what the demand is.
Ms. Lepping, do you have I have a couple more questions on this issue. One is, you said that some of your information is stored electronically and other information is paper. Are you distinguishing in terms of what you're charging between the electronic data that might be much less expensive to retrieve and copy and the paper data?
No. I don't, and I don't. Certainly the retrieval, Senator Olson, the retrieval costs would, the difficulty of retrieving data that's very old, you're right, would require more time than it would be to retrieve an image of documents.
So, Ms. Lepping, when you're retrieving that electronic data, which might be a couple hundred dollars or a couple hundred pages worth of data, but really doesn't require any more effort to retrieve, whether you're retrieving one page or 200 pages, are you charging the person, or would you contemplate charging them for the full 200 pages at a 65 cent a page rate when you're retrieving electronic data?
Senator Olson, even once you have retrieved the image, you still need to make a paper copy of it and provide it to the individual. So to the extent that they are only asking for portions of the file, you still need to go through a file that may contain hundreds and hundreds of documents and find the documents that they want and copy it for them and give it to them.
Ms. Lepping, why would you have to copy? Is it necessary that you have to make a paper copy? I know that a lot of attorneys are requesting the data electronically. They're requesting it on a disk or through email, and even the court systems are accepting data that way now. So is it always the case that you have to make a paper copy?
It's my understanding that Senator Olson, I'm sorry, I don't have the knowledge to answer the question as to whether the department has the ability to transfer the data onto like a CD not. So I can't. I'm assuming based on the cost, the how it's been costed out, and that we would have had a different cost potentially if it was on CD, that I'm making the assumption that we do not have that ability to transfer the data that way.
Ms. Lepping, do you have available for this committee the actual figures? Are you charging at a rate of 25 cents per page for this data now, Ms. Lepping?
No.
How much are you charging?
65 cents a page.
So that is what you... So you're asking for our authority to charge the rate that is what you have been charging?
Yeah. And I believe the consequence, Senator Olson, the consequences of reducing the rate would reduce the service.
Has that rate been challenged, or why are you coming to us now asking for us to approve that rate?
Because of the changes that have been made, Senator Olson, the changes that have been made in the charge, in the cost that in the Data Practices Act of what can be charged. Our finance director was previously under the impression that the practice that we had was still permitted under the Data Practices Act. The advice of myself and my staff to her is that we weren't certain that that was the case, and that consequently we would need to be confident that we were properly charging, we would need to seek legislative clarification.
And what does the Data Practices Act purport to allow you to charge right now? Just generally, what is the charge?
Senator Olson, the Data Practices Act has several different provisions that potentially apply to this data and what you can charge. There is actually a provision when you ask for copies of this type of data in, I believe it's even in the Department of Administrative Rules that talks about charging actual costs. There are sections of the Data Practices Act that talks about what you can charge for public data, and there's provisions of the Data Practices Act that talk about what you can charge an individual for data about themselves. So consequently,
can you tell us what those rates are?
I believe for public data, it's the 25. $0.25 for up to 100 copies, and then after that, it's actual costs. For an individual, the data, I believe that I'm not sure what the cost is if an individual is requesting data about themselves. But then there also is a provision in the Department of Administrative Rules where I believe if an attorney is seeking the data or someone, a representative of the individual is seeking the data, then it's also actual costs. But I'd have to defer to Lori Byer-Kopensky as to where that provision is.
Madam Chair and members, my name is Lori Byer-Kopensky with the Department of Administration. Mrs. Lepik is right. Currently, there are two different fee structures. In 1303, there's the cost for public data, which is actual cost for everything over 100 pages. But actual cost includes both the time to make the copy as well as retrieve the data. For a data subject under 1304, the data subject, when it's about me, it's my file, the only thing that person gets charged is the cost of making the copy, so not the retrieval costs associated with it. So typically, most agencies see the cost for a data subject as being something less than 25 cents a page or actual cost for searching and retrieving.
Okay, thank you. Senator Limmer, did you have a question?
Well, Madam Chair, we've had a lot of discussion over the years about the cost of gaining information by the public from government. And in general, as a principle, we've tried to keep the cost of any public member or any individual wanting information on the government or any information pertaining to any public discussion to be as cheap as possible. It's never intended to be a cash cow for any of our political subdivisions or state government. The reason we go in that direction is we want to make sure that the public has the greatest amount of financial freedom in gaining as much information on the government in making decisions as possible. Similar to the transparency argument you made in the last bill. Whether or not the 65 cents is an accurate figure, I'm not sure. And the question that I had is, it appears as though every other agency and department can duplicate these costs at 25 cents a page. And so 65 cents seems to be a bit excessive to me. And you did have the very same question that I wanted to ask. If an individual came and asked for one page of paper to be copied, and they had to go walk down a hall, turn left, go to a vault of some sort, retrieve it, then run back to a Xerox machine, and then bring it back and sell it to the individual requesting it, maybe that's worth 65 cents. But if the individual goes down the hall, picks up 300 pages and brings it back, is it worth 65 cents a piece when it's only one trip, not 300 trips? So I doubt very much that this type of data is totally encompasses just one or two pages. It seems like it's a volume of pages. And lacking a better breakdown of the costs, I'm a little hesitant to approve a 65-cent figure. Also, I know that we've had discussion about the use of computer disks in order to retrieve data from government by a requester. And that isn't addressed here under cost of copies. I don't know if it's just you put a disk in a computer, you download the requested information, and it's handed off to the requester across a public desk. A computer disk is about, I don't know, a few dollars, maximum maybe $9, but depending on how much data you can accumulate on that disk.
And Senator Limmer,
I don't know if this particular agency is prepared to give that type of information on a disk, but it certainly would help the requester wanting to know what government's doing.
Well, and Senator Limmer, I think this is being encouraged to happen more and more commonly. And in fact, I thought a couple of months ago about the possibility of bringing to this committee some proposals for requiring government agencies to provide public information to requesters, or private information if it's from the subject, in the most cost-effective way possible. But I think that it's going to require more study. And so, Senator Betzold, do you have something?
Let me point out, Madam Chair, if Ms. Banias has the statute there before, the section on page 2, line 33, refers to section 13.03, subdivision 3. That section is access to government data. And that section refers to 100 fewer pages, black and white, letter legal size is not to be used. That's where it's set at 25 cents. That's government data. If you look at, it's public government data, public data, I'm sorry. But if you look at 13.04, that's access to data by an individual. Stored data as an individual, which I think is what's referred to in the workers' compensation data. This is access to individual data, right, on people.
Senator Betzold, I think, typically it might be things like medical records.
Right.
Work records. Pardon me, Senator.
Date of birth, birth records.
Just a whole host of information related to a particular person that has had to be submitted through the workers' compensation process.
Right.
And a typical request for some of this information might generate potentially bills that run from anywhere from $50 to even a couple of $100.
But my point, Madam Chair, is that if it's access to data by an individual, the responsible authority may require the requesting person to pay the actual cost of making, certifying, and compiling copies, and that the requirement of 25 cents per page is not part of that. So I'm not sure whether or not the department here was looking at 1303 or 1304.
Madam Chair.
And maybe counsel could help me on that one, too.
Senator Moore.
Madam Chair, what I'm hearing in this discussion, though, is that because we do have an expectation that this is provided as a service to individuals who need the documentation for their cases. And so from a broader public policy standpoint, we allow some general rules when we allow the department to set certain reimbursement rates in other arenas to help them do what they need to do. And I think that in general, if that's a direction we're going, we've seen plenty of bills that says, Madam Chair, in your sibling adoptive sibling bill, we had language in there that as the department is assisting these people, the department would set the appropriate reimbursement rate to assist in these services. And so I think that what I'm concerned about is that if we – and what I'm hearing is that currently they are charging 65 cents and that covers the cost. And if we lower the cost, if we tinker with that a little bit, I'm concerned about what that will result in terms of its impact on people's ability to access information for cases moving forward. And so,
Senator Moi, I appreciate your concern. I guess my concern, and I'll just be very frank about my concern, I've seen in private practice that the cost of copying records, which are necessary for civil causes of action to move forward, and in this case, often people who are injured to obtain copies of their records that they need, that so often these costs get, because there's something about litigation that somehow attracts the ability to use that to make a profit on the medical on in the private sector on the medical side of things, charging costs even greater than this cost, but in this range, is so profitable that it has generated a private industry to come in and make a business out of copying this records, because at this level it becomes very profitable. And so what I would have hoped to see, to feel comfortable with this, to see is some indication, for example, by the questions that I asked, that you're it's obviously a lot more expensive to copy one or two records if you're trying to meet your personnel needs than to copy a lot of records, and it's less expensive to get electronic records than it is to get paper records. And so I would have liked to have seen more something that was more reflective of the actual cost. And I guess, can you tell me, Ms. Lubick, how much money totally is generated by the department at the present time for copying these records?
Senator Olson, I can't. I can only tell you that this cost, this amount is based on what it actually costs to provide the service,
okay,
and that basically the number of pages that we regularly copy divided by, you know, it's a basic mathematical problem.
Well, just so we can move on, Ms. Lubick, I don't know whether we're going to get entirely through this bill, but if we don't, I would really appreciate it if the department could come back to us with that information and give us I'm sure it's information that's readily available. How much money is actually generated by copying these records? And then we can see whether that seems like a reasonable number in comparison to the salary, say, of three employees to do the job.
Senator Olson, can I just add one more comment in terms of, as the, I mean, there is things that, I mean, one of the benefits of having the agency be the official repository of this record is that because these claims can go for years and years and years, and or that they can recur 20 years later, this one of the services that the agency is providing to the injured worker and all the parties to that claim is that they know there is an official record. It's not in some lawyer's office who handled the initial claim. It's not in archives, in, you know, from OAH. And so consequently, though this the department has no need for this data, we are not keeping it for our administrative and enforcement purposes. We are maintaining it for the purposes of the work comp, having this work comp system run effectively and efficiently, and relevant information to that system is maintained with some integrity. And so consequently, there is a service that's also provided, which isn't incorporated into this charge.
Ms. Lubick, though, that I appreciate what you're saying, but you've testified here that this is intended to just pay the actual cost of copying the records. And since that information, I'm sure, is available to know how much you're getting for copying these records in a year, I appreciate your point. I would like to know what that information is.
Senator Olson, I wasn't saying that as an option. We will provide you with the data. I was just trying to explain to you that there's this is different than some of the typical situations where an individual wants access to government data. If this were the typical government data, it would long since been destroyed on a records retention schedule if it was only for the purposes of the department. But because the department is the official repository of this data, it is, I believe, different than your typical government data.
Thank you. Senator Betzold?
Well, Madam Chair, as you indicated, I think what we probably should do is just, you know, the issue's been raised. I think we're going to need further information on it. Maybe we can just move to Section 7. Or perhaps if there's anybody here who wants to weigh in on Section 6 before we move on, just only Section 6, and then before we get to 7, maybe.
Okay. I know we do have someone here who wants to testify on this bill, but I'm not sure if it relates to this specific section. No. Okay. I guess we'll move on then, Senator Betzel.
Section 7.
Section 7, the first part of this section is definitions, of which there are only four, and fairly straightforward. As is true with many agencies, what they call, and we have many different terms for an investigation, and so consequently this encompasses the various terms of investigation. It clarifies what's an enforcement action. Obviously, department commissioner is fairly straightforward. So therefore, starting with line 3.19, we get into this substance of the bill. The department in this first section, sub B, 1 and 2, is we are responsible for wage and hour compliance, compliance with child labor laws, compliance with certain sections of Chapter 181, and obviously compliance with Chapter 176, which is the work comp statute. What this language would do would protect the identity of individuals, and it's limited to individuals who have made a complaint with the department. It also would protect the identity of individuals who have responded to a department's request for information as part of a department investigation or enforcement action. Okay. The reason for these proposed amendments are that to protect individuals from, because usually it's in the context of an employment situation where people have come forward with complaints or where the department has requested information from individuals who are typically employees to protect their identity such that they would not and protect them from reprisal. And also, of course, would assist in having people be more willing to come forward and provide the department with information. That's then on subdivision lines 3.28 to 3.31, what this clause is intended to get at is that, as I stated earlier, the department maintains what it calls as the division file, which is all of the data that relates to an individual's workers' compensation claim or injury. That can include investigations that the department has done, for example, where an insurer is not timely paying benefits, or where an insurer has improperly denied a claim for benefits. The department will engage in investigative and enforcement activity, and in some instances, there are actually penalties owed to the employee in addition to penalties that can be paid to the department as a result of these various activities. So the department has that information will be put into the employee's file, division workers' compensation file. Other areas of law in the workers' compensation statute allow an employee to get access to and other parties to the claim. The insurer and the employer allows them to get access to that file. And so this provision says that it's private, but to the extent that the data would be put into the individual's workers' compensation file, then those persons who can get access to that data elsewhere in the law would have access to that data. And mainly the people who have access to a workers' compensation claim and injury file is the employee, the employer, and the insurer.
Okay. Just Do the members have any questions up to this point? Okay. Senator Moore?
Madam Chair, the definition of department, there's a precarious inclusion in there about the Commission of Labor Industry and persons employed by the department to perform responsibilities under laws within the department's jurisdiction. But we also have this or contract or under contract with. And I wondered if, Ms. Leppett, you could explain that a little bit. Are these independent contractors, or are these kind of people who are brought in-house for on a short-term basis?
Senator Moore. Particularly in the construction code and licensing, the inspectors who are actually out in the field, some of them are under contract with the department, and they are not the department's employees. So for example, the electrical inspectors, the field investigate inspectors are under contract with the department.
Senator Ma?
Madam Chair, so what this is trying to do is to say that when they act in the capacity under which they are under contract with the department, they are department personnel. I mean, they are the department. When they showed up, they're the department. But from a liability standpoint, they're independent contractors, I guess.
Ms. Lepic?
They are not the department's Senator Mua, they are not the department's employees. They provide services to the department via a contract.
Ms. Lepic, I have a question that just raises some questions in my mind. So in terms of dealing with the privacy of this data, how do you handle that with people who are under contract? Do they have to sign an agreement with you? Do they have any liability for release of information? Or if they're not a government employee, do we make certain that this data is protected when it goes outside the department? I guess that just raises some concerns in my mind.
Senator Olson, the Data Practices Act provides for what needs to be included in a contract when the department contracts with an individual, and that individual may have access to data that's not public. And so consequently, by contract, they are obligated to treat the data the same as an employee would be obligated to treat the data. But that, and the agent, Senator Olson, agencies on a regular basis contract either through professional technical contracts or otherwise with persons who are not employees of the department. And it is a given that in all of those contracts, there is a clause that requires that entity or individual to be bound by the requirements of the Data Practices Act.
As we're going through this bill, then up to this point, do we have anyone who wants to testify or address the issues that we've just covered, or should we move forward? Mr. Neumeister.
Madam Chair, if I may approach, I don't know what approach you're using. I have a general thing about the whole general bill, and I don't know if you're doing presentation section by section, or are you doing it generally because...
Well, Mr. Neumeister, we may get through this bill, and then you'll have a chance to testify about the whole thing. I think we're getting toward...
We're almost done.
Yeah, we're almost done, so why don't we finish the bill?
Madam Chair, let me just suggest, too, that on page 3, line 10, where it says, or under contract with, as I understood the testimony, these are only inspectors. So I wonder if it might be better to just put or inspectors under contract with, because if that's all we're talking about, maybe we should limit it to that.
Ms. Lepic?
I believe that's Senator Olson, I believe that's the case. This area is a little bit new to me because prior to acquiring the code, these various code units, the department did not have this kind of contractual relationship. And so what we were, what we were trying to do in this bill is to make sure that, in essence, we were making affirmative statement that these people were going to, on some instances, have to be able to collect and have access to private data. But I believe most of them are, I believe they are called inspectors, but not, I haven't reviewed the contracts to know whether that would be a sufficient term to use to adequately identify them. But I can find that out, and in addition to finding out about the costs, such that we could insert a term that would be appropriate.
Senator Betzold, are you satisfied with that for now?
I think I'd like to tighten up that little phrase, but I don't. If we don't have the exact word tonight, since we're probably not going to, we're not going to have to revisit this bill. I think that's just one thing we'll have to check back on. So.
Okay, Ms. Lepig, would you like to continue, please?
Yes. Then moving to line 3.32. The department, one of its responsibilities is the apprenticeship program, is to monitor apprenticeship programs. One of those duties involves where particular, it's usually a sponsor of an apprenticeship agreement wishes to terminate that agreement with the apprentice. There's provision in Chapter 178.09 that provides for a process by which complaints can be handled. And as I said, my experience is that that primarily is in the context of where a sponsor of an apprentice wants to terminate the agreement. So what this and what the process is that the complaint's filed with the department director conducts an investigation if he thinks or she thinks it's appropriate, makes a determination. That determination then can be appealed to a hearing board, which is comprised of three members of the apprenticeship council. That apprenticeship council then conducts a hearing, makes a recommendation, findings of fact, and a recommendation to the commissioner, and the commissioner issues a final order, which then is appealable to the district court. But anyway, but for our purposes, what this does, the classification of that data is not clear in the law, and because I don't believe that investigative data, particularly in 1339, particularly fits the kind of investigation that the director is conducting. So consequently, this provision is to make is to provide some protections for that investigation data, primarily because a lot of the information that's collected can be very, it can go to issues of chemical dependency, it can go to issues of criminal activity, it can go to issues of just poor job performance, it can go to a variety of things that can come up in the context of a sponsor wanting to terminate an agreement. So this would provide for initially that data to be confidential or protected non-public. Once the director has made the determination, then it becomes private data on an individual or non-public, which means then it's accessible to the subject of the data. Then there's a typo here, and it should be on line 3.36, it should be not public data, may be disseminated to the board if there is an appeal, as opposed to non-public data, which has a different meaning in the Data Practices Act.
I'll move that amendment, Madam Chair.
Senator Betzel moves that on line 3.36, non-public data be deleted and not public data be inserted. All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion passes.
Madam Chair.
Senator Limmer.
On that same point, is it correctly spelled on page 2, line 16? There's a reference of disclosure of not public data. Is that correct spelling, or is that to be non-public? Page 2, line 16. Is that the correct reference?
I believe that's, Senator, I believe that's the correct reference.
Okay. Thank you.
Madam Chair, The next step in the process is that then the hearing board's recommendation would remain private and not public, which means that it would still be accessible to the subjects of the data, but not to anyone else. However, until the point in which the commissioner issues his or her decision, and then everything would become public at that point, related to the commissioner's decision or findings of fact, memorandum, the hearing board's recommendation would all at that point become public. So
okay.
This is just to deal with a gap that where the department perceived to be a gap in the law. We've attempted to balance the privacy and need for public access to data, government data, and the processes of the agency as best that we could. I believe it's consistent with how this similar kinds of data are treated by other agencies and would be generally the expectations of privacy of the individuals involved.
Okay. Thank you, Ms. Lepping. Moving on then.
D is two parts. One relates to surveys that are done pursuant to the Minnesota Prevailing Wage Law. Under the Minnesota Prevailing Wage Law, the department is required to survey employers to determine what they are paying their employees for purposes of setting a prevailing wage on a county-by-county basis. So the department, however, has a fair amount of difficulty in getting, and this will sound familiar, I think, for the Department of Transportation discussion, we have difficulty getting entities to respond to our surveys. Consequently, our data sample is not always the best. The feedback that we've gotten from persons who we requested to respond to our surveys is that they are concerned about trade secrets, they are concerned about competitive information that is included in these surveys. And so consequently, they want that data to be, certain aspects of those surveys to be private. The most important part of the survey, however, will be public, which is actually the payroll information upon which the department sets its the prevailing wage. The information that's listed here would not be public. Currently, 4iv is not public already under current law, so it's just 1, 2, and 3 that would be new to be private data or non-public data, which means, again, it would be available to the subject of the data. Any employee who was on reported, they would be able to see what was reported about them. The entity would be able to see what they get access to their data. But in this instance, the concern is competitors would not.
Ms. Lepping, the people we're referring to here, are these either public employees or these are private employees? So you're just using this to set the prevailing wage standard. I can see a lot of reason why employees might want to challenge how you determine, to be able to look behind your numbers instead of just accepting your word for it in terms of how you're setting prevailing wage. How are they going to make certain that my concern is maybe different from some of the other members, but in terms of someone who might be skeptical of the government setting these numbers, is there any way that they can monitor or
Senator Olson?
Ms. Lepping?
They would continue to have access to the actual payroll information that's provided. So they would have the way the surveys come in is has the name of the employer on the top. It has the list of employees and what the payroll required payroll information. At the bottom, it has the name and the signature of the person supplying the data. Under current law, the name and the signature of the person supplying the data is not public. What they would then get would be the name of the employer would be taken off, the names of the employees would be taken off, but the remainder of the payroll data would be on the document that's provided.
So, Ms. Loving, does that include the location of the business, or is it only going to be just raw salaries so you can't put it in context of where it might be have originated from?
Senator Olson, typically the requests for this data are by county. The individual wants to know how the rate was set for the county, because we set prevailing weights for each county. And so consequently, by the way that the individual requested the data, they would be able to determine what the what county that data came from. For example, someone could come in and say, provide all the prevailing wage data for Hennepin County, and we would then provide them with what I described that was submitted for purposes of setting the prevailing wage rate for Hennepin County. So consequently, they would be able to know the location, that data was used to set the prevailing wage rate in Hennepin County.
Would there be any reason not to disclose at least the zip code information as we had in the last? Because my county is a pretty large county, and there are various zip codes throughout the county is there any reason not to make that information available?
I don't, Senator Olson, I don't believe there would be any reason not to make that data available. I'm not sure of what value it would be to the person requesting it, but that's certainly we could leave the zip code of the employer for whom the payroll data was submitted.
Senator Betzold, do you?
That probably ought to be something we ought to consider too. Again, I don't know. Summary data, can be released. And I'm assuming when you're doing prevailing wage studies, that is going to be in the summary data now. How it's broken down, I don't know. I mean, the department's going to have to explain, just how the data is released and, what it shows. But I think that's something they have to take a look at. So.
Okay. Well, maybe we'll just move by that then, and we'll make another notation on that issue.
For Senator Olson, for purposes of allowing for the zip code to be released, is that what we're talking? Okay.
As part of your summary data.
Okay. Then, Senator Olson, regarding beginning again at line 4.14, the department also conducts surveys for varieties of reasons. It research surveys because we are mandated by the legislature to do various kinds of research with respect to all sorts of things, whether it's treatment parameters, cost containment, utilization, PTD, permanent total disability ratings, which are based on what kind of injury and severity of injury. So the department conducts a variety of research where we will request information from injured workers. We would request information from employers who have had work comp claims, from insurers who have paid out on work comp claims. And so consequently, again, in the area of comp, particularly when you're dealing with medical data or even the fact that someone has a work comp injury, can be very private information. The purpose of this is to say we will release we can protect the identity of persons who have responded to the surveys. And Senate Counsel added the word for request for written data by the department. I don't know that we do very many telephone surveys, but we may. So this is simply allowing for us to protect the identity of individuals responding to our surveys, which if we were forced to disclose could reveal the fact that someone has a work comp injury. In particular, that's a concern of the department, because if we survey only people who have injuries, then if somebody asks for our responses to that survey, then we would be identifying, you know, everyone in our system that's had a work comp injury that we sent that survey to, and consequently we would be disclosing that they have a work comp injury. Also, employers often are very concerned. We also survey, like, rehab providers in terms of their effectiveness in getting people back to work. So, again, all of this data, both the entities and the individuals are not going to want to respond to our surveys if their identity is public.
Do any of the members have questions up to this point? Okay, thank you, Ms. Lepig. We can keep going then.
Okay. It gets faster after Senator Olson. Okay, 14.16. The department wants to be able, when we do our investigations of employers for payroll, particularly overtime, minimum wage, we often request them to provide us with payroll data to determine whether they're properly paying people, whether they're properly paying overtime. We have no control over what the employer provides us. It's however they've maintained that data. It often includes all kinds of things, child support withholdings, all kinds of stuff is often included in that payroll data, including Social Security numbers, names and addresses of employees, et cetera. So what this will do is allow us to take off the identifying information on that payroll data, so people who don't even know that their employer has provided us with that data often will not have that data made public by the agency because a third person comes in and says, I want all the data that's been provided by, you know, was provided by this employer, which would then require us to give them the entire, all of the data that was provided by the employer. There's no protection for it other than the Social Security number. So what this does is at least allows us to take the identity of the employee off of that data before we make the rest of it public. Again, the whole purpose of this is this employee's had their data provided by their employer, and the law would compel us to make that data public under current law. So this is just to protect those individuals who may not even know that their data is out there, because they don't even know that their employers provided it to us. Section F, this provision of the Act mainly clarifies that the department may access, use, and disclose data to perform its performance responsibilities under the law. What the department is concerned about, particularly in the area of work comp data that has very strong limits on it, that we can actually, the department may use this data and disclose it as necessary. And when I mean as necessary, it's, for example, my personal experience. I'm in a settlement conference with an employer in an OSHA case. They're sure that it was not their employee hanging off the side of the roof. I have a photograph that proves that it was their employee. I want to be able to, in that settlement conference, show them that piece of investigative data so I can resolve my case and not have to go to hearing, and then at that point only be able to disclose it to them because otherwise it would be investigative data. There are other instances similar to that. For example, we have a case now where we have allegations against improper charging by a pharmacy. We only can pursue that investigation by revealing certain information about the various individuals that the charges have been improper to effectively do that investigation. Consequently, we may need to reveal some of our investigative data in order to fully complete our investigation. So this is what the kind of disclosure that I'm talking about. And otherwise, it's just simply having access to it and using it within the agency.
Senator Betzold, on line 4.19, do you have any similar concerns related to the under contract language there?
I did actually raise that the other day, and I pointed out that if people under contract are going to be releasing and disclosing data, I wanted to look at that. So.
Senator Betzel, I believe that the language that you proposed was with the permission of the department, persons employed by or under contract with the department may access.
And Madam Chair, my concern was that if somebody's just under contract and they've got this sensitive information, they disclose it, I think the department has to give permission to do that. You know, perhaps, again, you know, we're going to be laying this bill over, but we need to identify some language that can accomplish that.
Okay, thank you. Senator Betzold.
4.24, the Department of Labor and Industry provides training, education and training for loggers. That, having participated in that training, is information that is needed by Department of Natural Resources and other private entities for purposes of other related programs. What this does is, it's our understanding that under current law, this we can't release the data that's listed here because it would constitute education and training data that is protected under the Data Practices Act. What this will do, we've conferred with both DNR and the private industry as to what they need to confirm that loggers have participated in these seminars and programs. The list that you have in front of you is what they say they need in order to confirm that the requisite training has been provided, and so consequently they can, the employers who employ these loggers can participate in these various programs. Okay, H, if the department, the last section, I believe, or second to last section, involves department often has, because of the situation of minimum wage workers, they often are hard to find once we finally obtain the wages from them for them from their employer. What this will allow us to do is the Department of Commerce has advised us that we can't utilize their unclaimed property process unless we can give them a Social Security number for these individuals. This allows us to share the Social Security number with the Department of Commerce so that they can put these wages in their unclaimed property program. The final provision has to do with
Ms. Loving.
Sorry. Yes,
I'm sorry I didn't bring this up sooner, but backing up to Section G.
Yes.
You said that it's necessary to be able to provide this information to prove that these people attended these classes to someone, right?
Right.
But I guess, I mean, I'm from a district where we have a lot of loggers, and I can think of reasons why they might not want all this information to be completely public when they're providing, I can just think of reasons why that might be a sensitive issue to them. Is it possible to make this information, to identify who you want to disclose this information to for that purpose and make it available to the person who needs this without making it totally available to the public?
Senator Olson, the way that this works is that the entity is a association who operates as a clearinghouse for this data. So if we put, I guess I'm concerned that your concern would just be undermined by the fact that if we provide it to that association, they are going to make it in turn public. So consequently, unless you give it to another government entity, if you let it outside of government, it is basically in the mainstream and it's public. So consequently, only if we were to limit it to another government entity would there be any privacy connected that would follow it. So consequently, if we give it to the organization that operates as a clearinghouse for this data, then in essence, it's public data.
Okay.
And the last section of the bill allows the department, when it will aid the law enforcement process or investigative process, to promote public health or safety or dispel widespread rumor or unrest, to release data, to make data public that would otherwise not be public. The best example I can give you of that is that recently the department discovered that many of these satellite dishes that are attached to the side of houses were not properly grounded in the numbers of thousands. And so consequently, the department, despite the fact that that data would be not protected non-public and confidential because it was investigative data at the time, we used this discretion to make that data public so that we could get the message out to homeowners that they may have a electrical or fire hazard in their homes and how they could go about correcting it and who was the type of contractor that they should contract with to do it. And also we were able to get out that we had worked out with the company that had installed them that they would be remediating as we were discovering the homes that they had installed them in. So that's the type of circumstance where the department would want to be able to use its discretion to release this data. The rest of the bill, the first part of the bill deals with this misdemeanor provision. The department, first of all, this section, the first sentence that's deleted, does not distinguish between private and public data. It's the names of any person supplying information at the request of the department. If we disclose it, we're guilty of a misdemeanor. It doesn't matter under this provision whether the data is in fact public or not public. So consequently, it's in conflict with all of data practices that would otherwise make the data public. The other part of the concern the department has with this provision is that there are civil and criminal remedies already in the Data Practices Act that apply to all government employees, and consequently to have this sort of unique misdemeanor provision regarding a very small subset of data really does not make good public policy. And then the last provision has to do with mainly concur, probably not a data practices issue, but also this idea there's other remedies in law than misdemeanor for people who don't provide us data that we've requested. But I accept Senator Betzold's concern that maybe that's outside of the purview of a data practices bill, and we would be all right with leaving that language in under the circumstances. And then when you get to
Ms. Lepping, I'm sorry, I lost you for a minute because I was which language were you talking about that he would?
It says any person who having second sentence, line 5.10, any person who having been duly subpoenaed shall refuse to attend or testify in any hearing under the discretion of the Department of Labor and Industry shall be guilty of a misdemeanor. I guess what we were trying to do, and in hindsight maybe not a good idea, was just to get rid of this misdemeanor language in this law because it's not a particularly effective way of enforcing the law. Currently, the department already has an authority to go pursue a contempt order in district court if someone fails to comply with our requests. So a misdemeanor really is not, I don't think, an appropriate remedy for this kind of action. There are more effective ones.
Senator Moore.
Madam Chair, and I believe Ms. Lepnick was there the other day when we heard Senator Chaudhry's bill where there were a couple of gross misdemeanor criminal penalties in a civil enforcement section involving the department. And what we did do was we deleted that because in that discussion it just seemed odd that when there were civil remedies available already within the department's authority that we would put in a criminal penalty. And it just seems odd to expect a prosecutor to – I mean, how do they even go about prosecuting something like this when a civil remedy is already available? So we did – I think we deleted that in the other bill.
Well, Senator Moore, from what I understood, Ms. Lepping said, and maybe I misunderstood, but I could ask Ms. Pontius, is there actually a criminal penalty under the general law that would apply to this in any case?
Madam Chair, I think it would have to rise to the level of contempt of court, and it would probably be prosecuted under that.
Senator Olson, and
Ms. Lepping?
That is authority the department has elsewhere in its law. So I think this is a legacy of a very old statute, which then has been added to and now allows for the agency to pursue compliance with its request for information in district court by utilizing a contempt proceeding. So,
Ms. Lepping, the question I have about that is, in order for there to be a penalty that would attach to the department, then if they violated the statute, would that require then, from what I think you're saying, someone would have to go to court and get an order, and then that order would have to be violated before someone would be in contempt, rather than there be a direct penalty? Or am I not understanding that clearly?
Madam Chair, are you referring to the first sentence or the second sentence of that, the deletion?
Well, I guess I was referring both. In terms of what Ms. Pontius said, she said it would have to rise to the level in order for them to be a criminal penalty for there to be a contempt of court. And I don't know how there'd be a contempt unless there had been some type of an underlying order.
Madam Chair, referring to the second sentence that's been deleted, the way that it reads is any person who, having been duly subpoenaed, the commissioner has subpoena authority, which would in essence be an order, which then if they failed to respond to the subpoena, then they would be subject to a misdemeanor penalty. Under other provisions in Chapter 175, and I believe in most of the other laws that the department has jurisdiction over, If an individual fails to comply with an order issued by the commissioner, the law expressly allows the commissioner to go into district court to get a remedy, typically contempt. And actually, I think, Senator Moore, I actually emailed you a list of them in response to an even earlier hearing that we were in. So consequently, this misdemeanor provision, first of all, it would be in criminal court, not in civil court, and you would have to get a county attorney be willing to take this case and prosecute it for you. With the civil remedy, I would say, as general counsel for the agency, it would be very unlikely that I would ever go to the criminal court to get compliance under this provision. I would use the civil process.
Okay. Senator Betzel, are you satisfied then with
that? I am.
Okay.
I believe the rest of the bill is basically just cleanup and deletions or additions that we share data with a variety of agencies to determine employment status of individuals. This just simply makes clear that amongst the data that we can share are Social Security numbers and employers' FEIN numbers, which are crucial information to when you're trying to determine someone's employment status. Then the next section deals with just simply where we can go into court to get compliance with our orders, which is what we were talking about earlier. This allows the agency not only to go in the county where the employer or the individual resides, but also in Ramsey County or in a county nearest to the offices of the Department of Labor and Industry. That's a fairly common provision in the law, that the department can always go into Ramsey County to get an order in addition to the county where the employer is located. Then the last section are just simply cleanup sections to make the law consistent with either the amendments, primarily with the amendments that we've proposed here today.
Thank you, Ms. Lepink. I know we've really kind of put you through your paces here, and it's been a long evening, so I appreciate your patience with our questions. Senator Betzel, I think there's someone, Mr. Neumeister, wants to testify.
Madam Chair, let me suggest that if people have concerns about it, let's take the testimony now, then lay the bill over, and then at the next meeting, whenever that will be, we'll come back and address the issues that have been raised.
Thank you, Senator Betzel. Mr. Neumeister?
I'd like to add something out, if I may.
Regina.
Chair, for the record, my name is Rich Neumeister. This is a bill that certain sections of is very bad policy for the state of Minnesota if passed as is. To start with, what I've handed to you is a number one page on their website, on Department of Labor and Industry's website.
Manager.
that talks about...
Mr. Neumeister, can I interrupt you for just a second? Senator Moan wants to make a comment.
Mr. Neumeister, are you going to testify to the bill or the A1 amendment?
Oh, the A1 amendment. To the A1 amendment. What you have handed out is a front page of the website of Department of Labor and Industry, which talks about a lot of the areas that they are into. Number one, secondly, you have a copy of 181A or 181, which also where they have a lot of enforcement items in there. One of the things that what brings us here is a case called Westrom, which was a major case against the Department of Labor and Industry, and which they got their hands slapped by the Supreme Court. And then what the Department of Labor and Industry has done then has sort of reacted to that by statements by representatives of the Department of Labor and Industry and by document. And I would like to at least talk about an opinion that was done by the Department of Administration after the Westrom decision came down. The recent Supreme Court decision in Westrom, which found that the department had erroneously classified certain data as public, triggered a careful reconsideration by the department of how it classifies and under what circumstances it may release the various data it collects, creates, receives, maintains, and disseminates. That's one of the major factors why this bill, this amendment, is now in front of you and which creates more on the side of secrecy than at least to balance more a little bit on for the public right to know, which is also very important for accountability, how an agency runs when it has a lot of power and a lot of information about many employees, and to make sure that we have work and safe conditions in the places that we work. So that's the main thrust of at least the comments. Now to get into the specifics of the amendment. Section 7, what it amends to is the general power of the commissioner under 17516. Now, if you go further on down, and at least if I can get this on the record, if this is the case or not, on line 3, on page 3, line 25, I spoke with Ms. Lepnick yesterday when I saw the delete everything. And when I talked about the word individual, it was my understanding that it may have been a mistake, and she was referring to it should be person, not individual, because a person deals with a company, you know, because generally you receive complaints from a company. Or are they talking about an individual person within the company? That was a point of discussion. But whether that case or not happened, the bottom line is one of the concerns I have in all the investigations that are done by the Department of Labor and Industry, what will happen after, I'll just give an example, an investigation is done, it's closed. And a worker, a news media person, a public citizen goes to the Department of Labor and Industry and asks, over the last 3 years, I would like to know if there have been complaints about ABC company that in the wage hour situation, child labor situation, or any of the other of the areas that the Department of Labor and Industry does. I contend that more than likely they would say it's not public. And that's one of the things that I'm interested to get clear on record, and if that's the case, then I think that's important to change. The other thing is that, let's say for example, if a member of the public wants to know of the number of complaints against a business, would that be public? I think there are a lot of areas here that there are certain things that are public, like for example, if in Board of Medical Practices and in other kinds of licensed kinds of professions, or even in the Department of Commerce, when there's an investigation done on an entity or a person as defined under Data Practices Act, which generally means a company, there is at least some information available to know. is a company being investigated or has it been investigated or whatever, maybe not getting access to all the data that's in the active file. I think it's important for public accountability for that to be clear before this bill passes on. Talking with Mr. Rogalski, Ms. Slepnik, and things that I have read, and where I know there's been a lot of discussion between the Department of Administration and the Department of Labor and Industry about this bill as originally introduced, and by comments that are on the public record as of yesterday saying, you know, generally, the Data Practices Act is fine, but we, the Department of Labor and Industry, we have to do things efficiently and effectively our own way. So therefore, this is how we see it. And I see that what we're doing, in my judgment, is at the behest of an agency that's running scared, and secondly, that we're losing some public accountability along with that. So, Madam Chair, members of the committee, that is my major point about that section. And the last one is about where you give a large amount of discretion to the commissioner. Remember, a number of folks go to where pots of information is. You have hundreds, maybe thousands, of very sensitive files on workers' comp kinds of issues and also in other related areas. So I'm curious to know, when law enforcement knocks on their door, what kinds of things do they give? In other agencies, there are some prohibitions in some areas. Madam Chair, members of the subcommittee, those are my points.
Thank you, Mr. Neumeister. Ms. Lepping, I'm not sure about the other committee members or if there's anything in particular you'd like to respond to, but I would be interested in hearing a response to the issue raised about when there have been complaints made about a particular employer or so forth, and the public is trying to get information about that relates to a business or their past practices. Is that information that has been public that we would be now making not available to the public?
I don't, Madam Chair, I don't believe there is anything in this bill that would change the law regarding whether or not a complaint or there was an investigation or whatever regarding a business. I don't, the section that Mr. Neumeister referred to only deals with the identity of an individual who has filed a complaint with the department or an individual who has responded to a request for information by the department. And then again, it's only their identity to the extent that it would reveal that they had filed information with us or that they had filed a complaint with us. That's what we would be protecting. I don't believe that would then preclude us when the law allows. There's all kinds of laws that deal with these things. We have licensing laws. If it's a licensing complaint, there's a section in Chapter 13 that deals with licensing. There's a section in Chapter 13 that deals with investigation data. There are protections in Chapter 176 that deals with what we can reveal about companies. And so consequently, to be able to tell you definitively, I can't, whether or not at any given moment a certain piece of data would be public or not. Other than I can tell you that for sure my name and telephone number is.
Business, there's non-public data up here, and they say individual down here. So I think that's part of the confusion.
Okay. Something Ms. Pontius is pointing out to me is that on page 3, on line 3.20, you're using non-public data, and then you go on from there.
I'm sorry. Yeah.
You go on from there in later sections on line 21, line 25, to talk about individual. And so data that identify an individual. And so it seems as though
Senator Olson, I would propose that this language is a carryover to the bill as it was originally drafted, and that now as written, the data would only be private data on an individual, and therefore we could delete or non-public data because it, all the sections that follow it now only are dealing with...
Yeah, Madam Chair, I'll move on page 3, line 20, delete or non-public data.
Senator Betzold has moved that on 3, line 20, delete or non-public data. All those in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion passes.
Madam Chair, I don't know if anybody else wants to be heard on this bill. If not, I'll be happy to have you lay the bill over for the next meeting.
Is anyone else in the audience who wants to testify on this bill? Again, I should make the members aware, if you'd like to, before we come back to reconsider this a final time to try to clean it up a little bit so we can pass it, that I do have a letter here from the AFL-CIO. Basically pointing out some concerns about this bill. And so, Senator Betzold, if you would take a look at this letter, maybe you can address these concerns as well before we finalize the bill. Senator Ma?
Madam Chair, and I understand that, you know, it's important for the record that if materials are given out to the committee as supporting documents for testimonies, that we ought to have an identification on the materials with respect to whom the material comes from. And so I know that Mr. Neumeister is maybe a public citizen, but he's a professional. And, you know, with Mr. Neumeister and anyone else who comes to testify before either the subcommittee or the Judiciary Committee, I think that we should have people give their information, at least their name and their organization, on the document so that in the record we know who submitted the information.
Thank you. And Mr. Neumeister, or anyone else who's here to testify in the future, if you would do that us that courtesy, we would appreciate it.
Okay.
Well, I think with that, since it's 20 to 10, are you ready to adjourn?
No.
Or should we keep
going? We've got some people have been waiting for.
Yeah. Oh, I'm sorry.
Madam Chair, why don't we take up your bills?
Okay.
All right.
Do the little one, so Ms. Laturner and Locker
can go home.
Okay.
1837.
Okay. Madam Chair.
You're the chair. Just call the...
Okay. Well, we're going to next take up Senate File 1837, which has to do with criminal history data. And we have some...
this is Ms. Laturner Locker from...
Let's see. Who do we have to testify on this bill? Thank you, Ms. Laturno.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Would you like me to...
Yes, you can just begin by presenting the bill.
Okay.
I think we have a delete all amendment on this bill. And so I think...
Madam Chair, I'll move the A1 amendment.
Senator Ma has moved the A1 amendment. All those in favor, say aye.
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 Aye. Opposed? Motion passes. Okay. Ms. Laturno, go ahead.
Madam Chair, I do not have a copy of the amendment.
And Ms. Laturno, if you recall in my office, we had discussed the fact that there was some confusion with the language, the way it was written in the bill in terms of what was the actual intent of the language. And actually, I had thought you were going to discuss that issue with counsel, but they apparently that conversation didn't occur. And they identified the exact concern that I had in terms of the language being confusing. And so this is their suggestion in terms of just making your point clearer. As far as making certain that it is clear to someone reading the statute what the intent of the language is.
Okay. Basically, Madam Chair and members, this language relates to a situation where an individual's name is used by another individual at the time of arrest or other proceeding within the criminal justice system, and that name is associated then with the criminal's criminal history. We have a process where we can verify that the innocent party is not the subject of the criminal history and would like the ability to redact that name from the public criminal history. However, we would like to be able to retain it in the private criminal history so it is available to criminal justice agencies and those with an informed consent.
Senator Moore.
Ms. Letourneau-Lacker, why would we want to retain that information?
Ms.
Letourneau?
Madam Chair, Senator Moore, because the individual who is the criminal uses that information as an alias or other information, and it is necessary for a criminal justice agency to have access to that information.
Ms. Letourneau, so for example, if you were trying to find that criminal in the future, you might know what aliases he or she might be likely to use. Would that be an example of why you would need that information?
Madam Chair, yes, that's correct. Or they may use it when they're pulled over or on a subsequent arrest, and the arresting agency would not know to associate that person with that criminal history unless they had the ability to search by that name.
Senator Moore.
Ms. Turnalacker, what if they are twin brothers, and one is John and one is James, and James gets arrested and he tells law enforcement that he is John. And now John has a criminal history and he wants that erased from the system because if you maintain that in the system, the next time he gets pulled over, doesn't his name, John Smith, get pulled up?
Ms. Turnalacker.
Madam Chair, Senator Moore, the name is retained in the criminal history. However, our records are based on fingerprints. So John could come in and we could verify through a fingerprint verification that John is not the subject of that record.
Okay. Thank you.
Ms. Letourneau, do the members have any... Were you finished with your testimony?
Yes, Madam Chair.
Okay. Do the members have any other questions? Senator Moore.
Ms. Letourneau-Lacker, I'm sorry that I didn't realize that you had not seen this amendment, and we put it on so quickly before you had a chance to look at it. Now that you've had a chance to look at it, is this consistent with the intent of your original bill?
Ms. Letourneau-Lacker?
Madam Chair, Senator Moore, yes, it is.
All right.
Is there anyone else in the room who wants to testify on this bill?
Madam Chair, I'll move that the contents of Senate File 1837 as amended be incorporated with the Omnibus Data Privacy Bill.
Senator Betzold has moved that the contents of Senate File 1837 be incorporated with the Omnibus Bill. All those in favor, say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion passes.
Sorry, Madam Chair. I just noticed that the word must be redacted from the public criminal history data. That is a change from the original language. It previously said may, and the difference is that we might have an individual who shares the name of another individual, and by requiring us to redact that name, we would then be eliminating the criminal's record from public view altogether.
Oh, I see.
Madam Chair, I'll move that reconsideration of the motion by which 1837 as amended was incorporated in the Omnibus Bill.
Senator Betzold has moved reconsideration of the motion. All those in favor, say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion passes.
Madam Chair, I'll move on page 1, line 19. The word must be turned or changed to the word may.
Whether they redacted or not. Redacted or not redacted, for whatever reason.
Senator Council has raised the issue that of what the question is, of what the standard would be for whether they do or don't redact it, if it's going to be just open-ended discretion or if there should be some standard in place that would help you to make that determination. So, Ms. Turner-Lackner, do you have any comment or suggestion on that?
Madam Chair, I would leave that up to the committee. I know of at least one instance where the only name on the record is the criminal's name, and he shares the same name with another individual.
Senator Betzel.
Madam Chair, of course, the language says that if the information is erroneously associated and a determination is made through a fingerprint verification that the individual is not the subject of the criminal history, then why would we not want to redact it?
Senator Betzold, and I was wondering the same thing, because they're still going to have access to the information. We're taking it out of the public record. And even though there might be a very rare case out there where somehow there's going to be some confusion caused or something, it seems to me that the whole point of doing this is to make sure that that's not available to the public so that we don't have people having difficulties because of an incorrect identification. So if it's just a may, it may never happen.
Right.
So, Senator Moi.
Let me draw my motion for the moment while we figure this one out. I don't have a motion before. So.
Well, Madam Chair, I guess if I was me Moi and I get pulled over and I said my alias is me Moi, aren't I myself? I mean, I thought here we were trying to say when I get pulled over, I say I am Warren Limmer. And we're trying to redact Warren Limmer's name from my record. And then you put in there, a.k.a. Warren Limmer, once in a while, so that we could address that in the database. So
one of us has an identity problem.
Especially, I feel like I do at the moment. Members, I think I'm totally lost.
I thought the whole idea of the redaction was to protect the identity of the individual whose identity is being used by somebody, you know, who shouldn't be using that identity. And so you redact their name from the record.
And Senator Moi, that's why I thought it was better when it said must instead of may, because isn't that what we want to do, is we want them to be required to redact it from the public criminal history?
But Ms. Letourneau-Lacker just testified that in the case where the criminal has the same name as someone else, so you can't redact it. And I guess I'm having a hard time.
Well, Ms. Letourneau-Lacker, would it help to just say the if on line 1.19, if we inserted between the and name, if we said something like the incorrect or the erroneous identification or something like that to make it clear that what we're trying to do is redact the information that's incorrect and not correct information?
Madam Chair, the only problem with that is that if two people share the same name, it's not erroneous. It's actually the person's name who committed the crime. It just so happens that it's also somebody else's name.
It isn't erroneously associated with the criminal history, is it, if in that case?
The innocent party, Madam Chair, the innocent party still may have some consequences, and we do have a procedure in place to flag the name and to give the innocent person a letter. That is a very infrequent circumstance, but it does happen, and that's the reason that we requested the May. It would be our intent to do it in most cases, but there will be a few that the only name is the real person's name and the innocent party's name.
Okay. Well, Can you walk, Madam Chair and Ms. Letourneau-Lack, can you walk through a scenario for us of how that would be the case?
Ms. Letourneau-Lackner.
Madam Chair, Senator Mua, if an individual, let's say Mary Olson, is arrested and she gives the name Mary Olson at the time of arrest, she will have a criminal history under that name. There may be another Mary Olson who is applying for a position with a school, and somebody does a background check on Mary Olson and comes up with the criminal Mary Olson's record.
Madam Chair, and that was my first question, and you said that because your criminal background history check was fingerprint-based, so when the non-criminal Mary Olson comes up, the criminal Mary Olson's record wouldn't be associated with that Mary Olson. I mean, that's the whole purpose of doing this, is to make sure that that doesn't happen, that people with the same names don't get tagged with the criminal records that doesn't belong to them. So I don't see what the problem is by asking for it to be a must.
Madam Chair, Senator Mua, the public data is, the criminal history itself is based on fingerprints. However, the public criminal history is available through a search by name and date of birth. So if I'm a public user, I can look up Mary Olson and get the records on whatever Mary Olson is there. The criminal or
Ms. Letourneau-Lack, yes. Can we back up for just a minute? Because when you first brought this bill to me, you described this as a situation where someone gives an alias. Most commonly, I'm arrested and I say that I'm Senator Moi. And once you determine through fingerprint identification that I'm not Senator Senator Moi, then Senator Moi's name is no longer part of the public record that goes forward, so that she doesn't have to worry about being associated with my crime. Now, I think that's a good thing to do, and we want to make sure that we protect people in the public from doing that, and we'd really like to not water it down with a may when we'd rather prefer that that be a must. But now the situation you're describing is a little bit different. You're coming at it from a different direction when you're saying someone is searching from the outside for information about me. And if I happen to have had the same name, I guess I don't see where the way this is, that this is requiring you to take anything off just because someone else might have had my same name, because I am, it wouldn't be incorrect information.
Well, Madam Chair, I mean, your example is, you know, so I get clean up, you're Mary Olson. A couple of weeks later, a Mary Olson comes to apply for a job, and you're now on the record as a real criminal with your name Mary Olson. The other comes up, her name is also Mary Olson. It flags your record to go along with her. The process should allow for that verification to take place to say, oh, yeah, you're not the Mary Olson who's really in the system. I would presume that we're already doing that, and that's not the intent of this bill.
And, Senator Moi, I agree with you. I think that's kind of a separate issue to me than what I thought what this bill was getting at. Ms. Letourneau-Lackner?
Madam Chair, the purpose of the bill is we have individuals whose name has been used by somebody else, and we have a process in place where we flag the public record, but the public record is so widely used and so easily accessible on the internet that people don't necessarily pay attention to the caveats and the fact that the innocent party has a letter that tells them that they're not the subject of that record. So that is the purpose of this bill, to be able to redact that name from the public criminal history. If we're doing a private dissemination of information, we have, you know, the informed consent, and we take precautions and can do a fingerprint-based verification before disseminating information. But with the public record out there for anybody to see, it's not that easy. The issue with the must and the may, if the only name on the record is that of the criminal, and it just so happens to be also the name of another individual, if we redact that name, that record, which should be public because an individual with that name has committed that crime, would no longer be available to the public.
Ms. Letourneau-Lackner, I don't know if there's some disconnect here, because just because someone else happens to have that same name and contacts you, it isn't going to fall within the purview of this language to be removed, because that name wasn't given as an incorrect name in the first place. Just because someone happens to have contacted you has that name, that there's nothing that's going to go away, because this is only applying to situations where a false name was given to begin with, and then we're only removing that false name.
I agree, Madam Chair. So I think that until we can be convinced in the instance that Ms. Letourneau-Lackner just identified, we wouldn't want the name to be redacted. Why wouldn't we? I mean, why? So I think that we should just keep the may in there, and let's just move the bill along. If the department or if Ms. Letourneau-Lackner could find a different way to convince us that in the second instance that she identified, this would somehow jeopardize, you know, the background checks that we currently have in place, we can always come back and revisit this before the bill goes to the floor.
So that means, okay, so Madam Chair, then I'm not on the same wavelength with you, because I thought that was the reason why we wanted must, not
yes,
may.
Yes, let's put must back in.
Okay.
Must. Madam Chair.
Senator Betzold.
The word or is in here.
Oh, no.
on line 19, the name, we've established we've got the wrong person. The name or other identifying information must be redacted. So theoretically, you know, one or the other, or both, I guess. You know, you're not redacting the name necessarily. If, you know, you're keeping you might keep the name in the database, but just get rid of the other identifying information. Or is that going back to, you know, if you've just got some information that's erroneous, the name or other identifying information, just get rid of whatever's erroneous.
Or, Senator Betzold, or should we just substitute an and for the or and say the name and other identifying information must be redacted?
I think or is more appropriate. But frankly, Madam Chair, I think let's keep the must in here. And okay. The bill is going to stay here for a bit. If we get further information, you know, to clarify it or better words, I think we can do it. But I'll move again the Senate File 1837 as amended be incorporated into the Omnibus Data Practices Bill.
All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion passes. And Ms. Letourneau-Lackner, this is just this bill is we're intending to keep it here to be added to the omnibus bill. So if there's something we're missing here, some important piece that we need to reconsider this, we can still do that. So we can still keep talking about this issue if we're misunderstanding the concern.
Madam Chair, I think after your last explanation, the fact that if it's erroneously associated with the criminal history, I think that clarified for me what how you see the must being appropriate. So
okay.
I think that'll be fine. Thank you very
okay.
much.
Okay. Thank you. Do we need to move the bill now?
No. You
we
keep
did.
It here. You don't
okay.
do just everything's laid over.
596.
Madam Chair, 596, that was the carrier bill, right, which has got the data practices, mm-hmm. temporary classification. I don't know if there's Ms. Breyer-Kopensky could go through it or whatever. or you want to just hold it over to the next one. It's your choice. But.
You've waited here so long. I guess I'm going to leave it up to you, unless the other members have.
Madam Chair, my kids are asleep, and we've been here. I don't want to for them to have to wait it all night and not have us go through the bill. So, Madam
okay.
Chair, if you're amenable to that, I'd like to maybe, you know.
Certainly. I could be wrong, but as I said, I think this is largely a technical bill and doesn't have controversy involved. So go ahead.
Madam Chair and members and Senator Moore, I hope my kids are asleep too. Each year, the basis for the omnibus is typically any temporary classifications that the Commissioner of Administration has approved. In 2006, the Commissioner didn't approve any temporary classifications, so we offered you some technical things that could form the basis for the omnibus. In Article 1, what we have is amending 1304 to permit designees to respond to data practices requests for individuals. And the change just allows for better consistency between how data subject requests and requests from the public are handled. So what you do is increase consistency between how different data practices requests are handled and just allow more government employees to be able to respond to requests. So we just, you know, kind of add the word designee in that section. Section 2 of the bill, what we are doing is eliminating a provision in that has erroneously tied the Bureau of Mediation Services and a data classification for the Department of Labor and Industry. So what we are doing in Sections 2 and 3 are just splitting them out so they both have their own sections since they are both their own agencies. And then Article 2 of the bill, what that does...
Excuse me.
Yes.
Ms. Beyer, I'm just wondering if we should maybe present the amendments that we have before we go through so that other
sure.
members can actually be looking at any changes that were made. And we have a number of amendments that I've received to this bill. There's actually six of them, I think. The A1 amendment, A2, A5, 7, and 8.
Madam Chair, are those are not technical amendments. Those are not author's amendments, are they?
A1 is protected.
I believe the A1 is a technical. Well, as you're going through the bill, were you intending? Are you referencing language with the amendments, or are you just presenting the original bill?
Madam Chair and members, right now I was just going to present the original bill, and then as you pull up amendments, I can describe them.
Okay, we can do that.
Madam Chair, some of them look like they may have some substance to
yes.
them, so I think you may not. I think maybe we should just go through the basic bill right now and
okay.
hold off the amendments until a later date.
So. Okay. Is that all you were going to say, Senator Moore? Okay. Okay, go ahead.
Okay, Madam Chair and members, and the last part of the bill is Article 2, and it makes in Sections 1 through 29, all it does is change the phrase, which is cumbersome, from state agency, political subdivision, or statewide system, to the defined term in data practices, the shorthand, which is government entity. So all it does is improve readability as much as is possible in the Data Practices Act. And that is a summary of the shell for the omnibus.
Madam Chair, I'll move that the contents of Senate File 596 be incorporated in the Data Practices Act bill.
Before we vote on that, is there anyone in the audience who wanted to testify just as to this bill without the amendments?
I don't think so.
Okay. Then Senator Betzel has moved Senate File 596. How should it state that?
Just the contents of 596. I mean, we still have to adopt what's in here as part of the bill. This is the basic bill, but I think, you know, we still want to adopt this because this will be in the bill with everything else that we're going to put in here. So
be adopted?
As part
on
of
that
the
motion.
Omnibus Back Practices Bill.
On that motion, all in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? Motion passes.
And Madam Chair, it's my understanding there were some other amendments, but we're probably going to have another meeting, and we can look at those amendments, plus anything else like the bill that I had earlier will be looked at as part of the overall bill again. So,
and Senator Ma, is that agreeable to you?
Madam Chair, I yes, because we still have to go through Senator Betzel's bill, and so I think that we'll probably have to do another meeting. And at that time, any members who have an amendment to the omnibus bill can then offer their amendments at that time.
Sorry, okay. A little more to the floor, though. That's the problem. Sorry.
I can hardly wait.
Okay. Meeting is adjourned.
Thank you.
And before you all leave, could we talk real briefly about schedules in terms of getting another, just to finish this up? Hopefully it won't take...